Senators, ready to go?
We go every, that's why I'm going.
Good morning and welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for September 22nd, 2011. We are very happy to be here very early in the morning. And we have some business to do this morning, but first off, I do want to do introductions because this is our first official interim committee meeting. And we do have one new staff person, so I'll make sure and go around and introduce ourselves. I am Senator Jackie Dingfelder. I represent District 23 in Northeast Southeast Portland. And I'm serving my 11th year. I think there's one other person on this committee that is more senior in more ways than one. But it's exciting to be back and very honored to be back chairing this committee. With that, I will pass it off to my vice chair.
I'm Vice Chair Alan Olson, Senator of, and I represent Senate District 20, and I've been here for 9 months.
Mark Hass, I represent Beaverton in Washington County. I was in the House since 2001 and in the Senate since 2007.
With a little hiatus in between. Thanks for being here.
Chuck Thompson from Hood River, District 26. Like Senator Olson, I've been here for 9 months, and I'm very proud to serve on the Senate Ag Committee.
And natural resources
and environment, that, yeah.
Senator, our senior senator?
What?
Floyd Przanski, State Senator, representing District 4. District 4 includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. It's also my honor and privilege to be still serving on the Environment and Natural Resources Committee and look forward to a vibrant agenda for today and in the future so we get ready to take care of work in the interim session.
We always have vibrant discussions and robust discussions here. And, of course, we would not be where we are today if it wasn't for our crack committee staff. And Beth, if you want to reintroduce yourself, we are fortunate to have our committee staff back that we had during the regular session.
I'm Beth Petrino, and this interim I'm staffing both this committee and the House Energy, Environment, and Water Committee, and happy to be here.
And I'm Christy Houck. I was hired on for the session, and then I'm hired on continuing on afterwards. So I'm glad to be here.
Great. Oh, cool. Thank you. So it's great to have Christy. Welcome. To have you here, and Beth, it's wonderful to have you back. And with that, we have some business that we need to attend to first. As you can see, we need to adopt our committee rules. We actually have interim committee rules that I'm going to ask Beth to talk a little bit about and how these rules are different from what we adopted during the regular session.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, there are a number of differences from session rules because there are actions that you take during a session that you don't during an interim. But in terms of a comparison of this set of rules to last interim, there are a number of wording changes that just clarify the rules, and then an addition of a rule that addresses what needs to be done to record or to keep a record of a field trip that a committee takes. Otherwise, they're essentially the same as they've been in past interims.
Okay, so are there any questions before I ask for a motion about these interim rules? I'm assuming everybody read them prior to coming here today.
Forwards and backwards.
Yeah. Okay, with that, I will take a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 9/22/11.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the proposed interim committee rules, I guess we should say, dated 9/22/11. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hass.
Aye.
Senator Przanski.
Aye.
Senator Thompson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder.
Aye. With that, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. And I guess, that was supposed to be a work session, wasn't it?
Organizational.
Okay, so with that, do I close the organizational meeting and then I'll open up the informational hearing for today. We have four agenda items today, very interesting agenda items and issues that we'll be working on, not just during the interim, but probably into the regular session. But first up, we're going to have the Department of Environmental Quality come up and provide an update on the Paint Stewardship Program. colleagues, our new colleagues, this program passed in 2009, is that correct? Mm-hmm. And so it's now been in place for, I think, well over a year, and we're going to hear an update from the Department of Environmental Quality on that. And we have Palmer Mason. Greg, are you going to come up as well? Okay, you're just here for backup. Great. So with that, we're going to hear from Palmer Mason from the Department of Environmental Quality. I've asked him to provide an overview for our newer Senate members that weren't here when the bill was initially adopted. So, Palmer, if you can provide an overview prior to the update, that would be helpful. Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Dingfelder and committee members. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. As you, Senator Dingfelder, Chair Dingfelder indicated, I'm here to give you a little overview of the paint product stewardship program here in Oregon and specifically talk about the date that the department will be providing the legislature the report that's required in the statute. And on that issue, the reason I'm here to talk about that is we've asked for a short extension, and I'll explain why momentarily. The bill, the legislation passed, as the chair indicated, in 2009, and what it set out was a program where when a consumer goes to buy architectural paint, this is the paint that you would use to for interior, exteriors of houses and buildings, that kind of thing. When that paint is purchased, they pay a fee. That fee is managed by a stewardship organization. It's a nonprofit that's organized by the paint industry, both the manufacturers and the contractors of paint. And that stewardship organization manages that fee for the purpose of collecting, recycling, and disposing of the paint. Turns out that paint was one of the household hazardous waste products that the local governments in Oregon would see. Actually, it was the largest item that they would see, the greatest volume in terms of the waste that would come to their facilities. And it turns out also that much of the paint that's out there is actually recyclable. The latex paint is recyclable. The oil-based paint, where it can't be recycled, is often used for energy recovery. So there's value in capturing the paint and not throwing it away in the landfill. So this stewardship organization collects the fee for the purpose of managing the paint in that way. This is something that is an initiative of the paint industry, and to their credit was a proposal they brought to DEQ prior to the 2009 session, and it turned out that Oregon passed the first paint product stewardship program, statewide program in the country. And this got encapsulated in the bill and became a pilot project. So there's a sunset date for this program in June of 2014. And prior to that point, DEQ is to submit a report to the legislature that describes how well the program is working, whether we ought to turn this pilot project into a permanent program, to account for the fees that have been paid to DEQ to manage the program, and then also finally to suggest whether there are improvements in the program that might make it function better and more efficiently. The bill that was passed in 2009 sets out a date of October the 1st for that report. We are asking for an extension of 2 months, although we hope to deliver the report to the legislature sooner than that. And the reason we're asking for the extension is there's a key piece of information that has come to us. It came to us on September the 1st, and that's the annual report that was written by the stewardship organization. And this was something they're required to do under the legislation. And that annual report describes how well the program is working. It's an evaluation. It describes what they've collected. It also describes the money that they received and where they've spent it and how they've spent it. So it answers a lot of key questions about this pilot project. Again, that report was received on September the 1st. The bill, as it was written, required us to do the legislative report, with including recommendations, 30 days later. And quite frankly, that just didn't seem to be enough time in our minds to adequately evaluate the annual report for this, you know, first in the country program, to give our stakeholders time to look at the report, develop draft recommendations, have a stakeholder process, a public comment process, so that we could get feedback on those recommendations, and then send a real good final finished product to the legislature. It just didn't seem, again, that 30 days was quite enough time to do that. So our approach over the interim was to talk to the chair. We also talked to the two chairs of the House Environmental Committee, and we simply asked, did it make sense in their minds to get a two-month extension where we would send the report in by December the 1st? And the answer we got back was yes, it was. And in fact, yesterday when I spoke to the House Environmental Committee, they indicated that that was fine to deliver the report later. And so our goal actually is to send the report to the legislature by the middle of November. And the reason for doing that is I strongly encouraged us to be early. That was one reason. And then secondly, it ties in with the second set of legislative days and an opportunity, if the committee so desires, for us to come back and talk in greater detail about the program, about what we've observed, maybe perhaps even hear from other stakeholders, and then we can certainly talk about our recommendations. So it seemed that it would be better to wait until November for us to deliver the report, and then if, again, the committee is interested, to come back and give a more complete discussion of the program. So that was the primary purpose for the extension.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Palmer. Question?
I do, and it's really, I think, for staff. I just mentioned this. I was going to put this on the record because I'm trying to figure out what authority do we have to give an extension of something that was in legislation that was passed by the two chambers. I have no problem with hearing the explanation as to why it's needed, and I personally have no problem with it going forward. But it seems to me that we need some clarification, because I'd hate to see us, let's say, make some type of decision that isn't really binding on the legislature and the interim stuff. And maybe as a suggestion, it may need to be done in two parts. You may need to give whatever you have with an explanation that a supplemental will be filed at whatever point in time. I just don't know, and I think that's a question that hopefully Beth can follow up on with LC and whoever else.
Yeah, we will have Beth check with that. We thank you, Senator, for bringing that up. We did have a discussion with DEQ and the co-chairs of the House Committee, as Palmer had mentioned, and they said as long as they come to this committee and give us an update, you know, it was fine. However, I think for Beth to check with LC and see if we need to have something official in writing that gets submitted, and then we can have more detail that's presented later.
Okay.
I think that's a good suggestion. Any other questions or comments for Palmer? Okay. All right, so we will be following up, Palmer. We definitely already have you on the November agenda, Senator Thompson.
I just have an unrelated question for Palmer. I met a constituent in Hood River that's a house painter, and he was concerned with the program that they came up with a couple of years ago. I'm not sure what year, on lead paint and the difficulty of painting old homes and the cost involved. What has your agency been involved with on that? How's that program running? Because it seems like he would explain to me it would cost like $20,000 to $30,000 to remove the lead paint, to do it properly, remove the lead paint, and to paint just anybody's ordinary old house. And there's a bunch of old houses out there. What is that program, and when
Palmer,
does it start?
If you could be succinct about it, and we'll probably have you do a follow-up.
Okay. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, that program is to manage the environmental effects of doing the paint, and it does require paint contractors to use certain best management practices and that kind of thing. But that's really about all I know about it, because DEQ doesn't manage that program.
It
is actually managed by the construction board. They are really the proper entity, but we frequently get calls about it, and I have heard quite a few that was actually mentioned yesterday in committee, in the House committee, and I get routine calls about it because people aren't sure where to go, and we have to send them over.
But who
to
would
the
I contact?
Other.
Well, we will follow up, Senator. I'll have Beth make sure and follow up. But the bottom line is that lead-based paint, which is no longer used, as I'm sure you know, but in older homes, is still quite prevalent, especially, for instance, in my district, where we have a lot of homes from the turn of the century and older homes that where paint is still being removed, and there's concern about the potential health effects to exposure from that lead paint, especially during removal, the especially airborne particulates. So it is something that I know the legislature has addressed and wanted to make sure that the paint removal process is done properly. And as Palmer said, it's not under the purview of DEQ, but we will, Senator Thompson, we'll make sure and get you the information because it is through a different agency. And we'll make sure and share that with the entire committee. Mm-hmm. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Thank you. So next up, we have an overview of the smart grid. And first of all, I wanted to just mention, you can see we have quite a few speakers on this issue. First, we're going to hear from Peter Christensen, who's the commercialization manager with the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. So I, along with several other legislators from throughout the country, have been part of a legislative workshop on energy issues. We met in, I think it was July. There's about, I think, 50-plus legislators from around the country that are going through this two-year institute. There's a handful of folks from Oregon, and I had the opportunity to hear Mr. Christensen give a presentation on smart grid, and I thought it was one of the best presentations on this issue that I'd heard. And I immediately went up to him and asked if he had travel money, because Mr. Christensen is based in Richland, Washington, the Tri-Cities area, and he did. And so we are fortunate to have him here today. We appreciate you traveling all that way to come here, but it's a very important issue. It's something that we've been looking at, working on in the state of Oregon, and many other states throughout the country, but especially in the Northwest. And so I really appreciate the fact that you're here today early in the morning, and that I'd ask Peter to provide an overview on smart grid and what it is and what are the key issues. And then we have reports from people in Oregon about what's happening here today, both from private, public utilities. As you can see, we've asked a member of the Smart Grid Oregon board to come, and then we have somebody from the Public Utilities Commission. So I appreciate, once again, you being here, Mr. Christensen, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Senator Dingfelder, and thank you to the committee. I appreciate being here. Again, my name is Peter Christensen. I'm a commercialization manager at Pacific Northwest National Laboratories, and this presentation, as Senator Dingfelder mentioned, was one I had prepared for an institute that, again, tries to educate legislators on some of the smart grid issues. So there are some aspects of this that are that maybe you know about, or I kind of had to get down to some of the basics on utility issues. So I'm going to do a little bit of a, before after the introduction to P&L, a little bit of a utilities 101, and I'll go through that fast. And by all means, if you have any questions as I go along, I'm more than happy to entertain them as I go along.
Thank you.
I want to talk about both supply-side solutions and what we call demand response. Those are two aspects of so-called smart grid that I want to talk about. And then maybe if we have time, I can talk just briefly about some of the policy issues. But I always have to talk just briefly about Pacific Northwest National Laboratories, because one of the largest challenges we have at the lab is letting people know we exist, that we have this incredible resource right here in the Pacific Northwest in South Central Washington. PNNL is one of the DOE's large multidisciplinary labs, national laboratories. We are based in Richland in the Tri-Cities area, but we do have a small office here in Portland, or up in Portland, and one in Seattle. This is our campus down in Richland, in the heart of wine country. We are a $1.1 billion laboratory. We have almost 5,000 employees, the bulk of which are at this campus in South Central Washington. The laboratory has made somewhat of a shift in the last number of years to go from just doing really great science to having that great science try to be a little more mission outcome, a little more mission focused. We identified a number of key outcomes that we want to focus on to lab. The second one here is where I fall into our goal to increase U.S. energy capacity and reduce dependence on foreign oil. Obviously, at a large lab like ours, that has many facets. And the one area that I want to talk about today is the electricity infrastructure. We are probably the nation's leading national laboratory on electricity infrastructure issues. We have invested in that at the lab to set ourselves up as that. So we do a tremendous amount of work in that field. And I can't talk about this without first asking the question, why? I think it's a reasonable question is why do we at the laboratory spend so much time and money working on the electricity grid when for decades, I mean, for most time, the utilities in this country have done a really good job providing affordable, reliable, and secure power. So I think it's worthwhile spending a couple minutes on talking about the challenges that are going on at the grid that are the reasons why we're doing all this work. And the first one is renewable generation. That's something that we've committed to, especially in the Pacific Northwest, talking about wind and solar, especially wind around here. Renewables are we all like renewables because it's green, it's basically free. The problem is that it's intermittent. You can't predict exactly when the wind's going to blow, and you don't know when the wind's going to start and stop, and that's a huge challenge for utilities. Right now, the U.S. is about 3% total capacity of wind, but as you know, a number of states have required certain minimums, clearly up to 15-25% renewable resources, and that's a huge challenge to the grid. That was not there before. I'll talk about demand response in a minute. This, I think, is the 650-pound gorilla in the room, and that's the what we call electrification of the transportation sector, basically electric vehicles. I'm pretty bullish on the future of electric vehicles. I think they're going to get adopted faster than a lot of people think, and I'll talk about this briefly later on if I have time. But you can imagine what the impact on electric grid would be if we all started taking all the energy from the electric grid to drive our cars, especially if we do nothing and people come home at 5 o'clock and plug in their EV right when utilities are peaking, the impact on the grid could be huge. And so that's another challenge that we're trying to address. Carbon constraints, that's not so much of an issue in this part of the country, but it certainly is in the East Coast. There's obviously still no carbon legislation, but you can imagine the impact that would have on utilities that are 70% coal. And suddenly, all their dispatch assumptions are completely changed. So we look at that as well. And then finally, I could spend an hour talking about cybersecurity, but I won't. But that's another layer of things that we get involved with. So just a level set. Let me just talk about a few basics that I think that I just want to make sure everyone's aware of. When we talk about the grid in the United States, we're actually talking about three grids. The United States consists of three separate grids. The entire electric system from about the Continental Divide that you see in the chart there to the east is one large interconnected grid. Every machine is operating at the same frequency, even the same point of rotation. Then everything to the west of the Continental Divide is one interconnected grid. And then, like I say, for historical and cultural reasons, Texas is its own separate, isolated grid.
I was going to say the same thing, but I figured it out.
And we can see where the transformer went out in Arizona and impacted San
Diego. I'll talk about that briefly. Actually, for the lawyers, we're not raising some interesting jurisdictional issues. You can imagine being down in Texas, but that's another story for another day.
Well, some of us cannot imagine being down in Texas, but that's okay.
The one thing about the grid that you have to understand is that it was never designed from the top down. It wasn't designed this way, you know, to start from a large interconnected grid and then, you know, from the beginning. It was really grown from the bottom up. Every one of those little white circles is a control area, or what we call a balancing authority within the grid, that a utility or a group of utilities or an organization like the BPA that has the responsibility to match load with supply on a minute-to-minute constant basis. But as you can see, especially out east, those control areas, I mean, there are hundreds of them, or about 128 to be exact, of these control areas that have that responsibility. Now, and again, they've all grew up just having that responsibility for their own little remote part of the country, without too much view of what the rest of the controllers around them are doing. In 1965, that lack of coordination among those different control areas led to a large outage in the East Coast, which led to the formation of something called the North American Electric Reliability Council, or NERC. And those shaded areas are the various NERC regions among the United States where the utilities at first voluntarily got together and said, we need to start thinking about how our grid operates together. We need to start doing some planning, at least talk to each other, and set up some minimum guidelines on how we're going to make sure the grid is balanced. Remember, the fundamental challenge here is that you're constantly having to match supply and demand. And if that gets unbalanced, then you're relying on the rest of the grid to support you, and that's a problem. So for many years, these NERC regions were handling issues like how power is moved across the grid and how the grid's balanced. Until 2003, and I'll mention this also a bit later, there was another large outage in the East Coast where finally the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, decided to make all those NERC rules, they rhyme but they're not related, make them mandatory. So now the most of the NERC balancing rules are now mandatory for most utilities. And again, I say that because one area where we talk about the smart grid where a lot of work is going on is trying to improve this overall balance. Like I said, in 2003, there was another large outage in the East Coast that caused the system to go unstable. One of the reasons they found about it is that the utilities just did not have a good, what we call, situational awareness. There was not a good feel for what was going on at the grid at the time. And so a number of utilities and or utility suppliers and laboratories like ours are developing tools to try to change that. And let me give you a quick example. Without getting too hyper-technical, it's worth drilling down on this just for a second. I'm an ex-utility engineer. Back in when I was an engineer, I used to do something that we call a load flow analysis, where you make that's where you do the modeling to show how all the balance, how the loads are being fed. Well, utilities are required by NERC rules to always maintain the ability to deliver the load if there's some sort of event, what we call a contingency. Something bad happens. A big plant shuts down, a transmission line trips out. The grid needs to be able to handle that contingency and still serve load. So we do a lot of modeling that looks at every contingency. And that used to take, back in my days, it would take 25 minutes to run one case, and you get a big output of paper that big. And, of course, things have changed. Now you can do this analysis in seconds, but you still have a lot of analysis to do. So one thing that we developed at the laboratory is what we call a contingency analysis visualization tool. And this, again, is an example of how we're trying to improve situational awareness for utilities. And what we can do here, and you see the graph on the left, is we can actually perform all that contingency analysis, and we can say, where is there an area where if we have something go wrong, the system could go unstable? I mean, this is before it happens. This is on an operational and even planning basis. Where are we going to have a problem? And we can do it very basically, show it in red, and that's what we do. We want to have something that operators can see right away without having to look through reams of data. So you see on the chart on the left, we could say in this particular situation, if something bad happens, the West could go unstable. This same software can also actually recommend remedial action to decide, okay, here's something you can do to remove that, or to solve that remedial action. And a classic example, Senator Dingfeld, just like you mentioned, is what happened in San Diego. They have a lineman in Arizona who forgets to take off his safety grounds, and that causes all of San Diego to lose power. That was a classic case of the grid being in a situation where the operators in San Diego were, or that in Southern California, were not quite aware what the risks were, where a single contingency, one bad thing that happened a long way away caused their system to go down. We would like to think that this tool could have prevented that. I'd love to show this slide. This is that big outage in 2003. You can see the black hole that it caused there in that satellite picture. This was caused by a situation up at American Electric Power. They were in a contingency situation. They had a large nuclear plant that was down. It was a hot summer day. And then it was a transmission line in Michigan that was the last straw that finally, within 9 seconds, took the rest of the whole Northeast out. But most utilities found out about it when the lights in their control room went out. They just simply did not have the capability to see. We like to say if we had the tools today, back then, we think we would have known about that. We've done the analysis. We have the tools at the lab to basically run a simulation. And we've run that simulation with real operators, and we've shown that we would have had about, rather than 9 seconds, we would have had about 45 minutes of warning on that particular outage.
Just a quick follow-up on that, Peter, for this, and my mother lives in San Diego, so I heard all about it in real time about what was happening. And obviously, it was a big burden. The airport was shut down. Businesses were shut down. I mean, the entire city was ground to a halt. Was there any, I mean, there was no warning at all No. that was issued in that instance? Because I'm wondering why this type of system didn't alert the operators.
Well, the system that I'm talking about here is not in place yet. I mean, these are under, I mean, we're still actually, they're under development, but that's what my job as a commercialization manager is, to get these tools out into the real world. And that's what I'm trying to do. And that's why I'm delighted at the opportunity to share these with you, because these tools do exist, and we're trying to get them displaced, but they're not there today. They don't have that situational awareness today that we think that they need, especially as the grid gets more and more stressed based on those factors I just got done talking about. So, you know, when we talk about smart grid, that's a long introduction to this question, what is a smart grid? And I think there's two fundamental aspects of it. Well, first of all, a generic description of a smart grid is basically taking this, you know, existing infrastructure and overlaying the new communication and calculational tools, information tools that we have today. But there's two aspects. There's a supply side and a demand side. I just got done talking about the supply side. From a utility perspective, there are tools that we call that are part of the smart grid movement that can help them optimize their system to make it more reliable, just like I got done talking about. There's another whole aspect that I want to talk about next, which is the demand side. Something called demand response, and that's another big area of the smart grid that I want to talk about. But first, again, I have to go back to a little basics, and I apologize, this slide got reformatted, got a little messed up, that line's not where it's supposed to be. But this is what we call, utilities got, engineers love to call, or love to look at, this is what we call a load duration curve. This is a analysis, and the, by the way, the thick black line on the bottom is transmission, the other one is generation, I lost my note on that one too. This basically shows the amount of utilization that the transmission and generation grid is using based on the number of hours per year. We basically take the amount of the transmission capacity being used and sort them from high to low. And what this shows is that the transmission system is really only used about at 75% or the top 5% of its capacity for less than 400 hours a year. Or I should say 75% of its capacity, less than 400 hours a year. You can see it's only using its peak amount of capacity, only a few hours a year. And the reason why is utilities, by their nature, are planned around the peak. That's their mandate, right? They have to serve that peak load. So they design their system around that peak. They find out when that peak is, and they build generation and transmission and distribution assets and get recovery for them based on that peak. The problem is that peak only happens a few hours a year. So for the vast majority of time, the vast majority of hours a year, the transmission and generation system is greatly underutilized. And that's the reality. And so what we're trying to do with both these types of systems is to try to change that so we get better what we call grid utilization. Let's take all those challenges to the grid, new EVs, wind generation, and let's address them by a better utilization of the grid that we already have. In fact, I have a slide on this, but I'm going to jump to it now because it's a great punchline. We did an analysis at the lab, one of those things that really put us on the map, that asked, you know, if we had EVs today, how many, if we fully utilized the grid based on this chart, you know, we filled in that white space, how many electric vehicles could we support in this country? And the answer was surprising. We determined that 73% of every car, small truck, and SUV in this country could be electric today without any new transmission or generation capacity in this country. 73%. I mean, that's just by utilizing the grid assets we have. We're talking about if you charge those vehicles at night rather than at the peak. I mean, so the capacity is there. It's just we have to figure out a better way to utilize it. And that's what I want to talk a little bit about next. Again, I got to go back to some basics here, a little grid 101, and please bear with me. I don't want to, this is important about setting up how we approach demand response. I think there's a lot of people don't realize that the electric industry on the wholesale side, not the retail, but the wholesale side, is a competitive commodity market today. Right now there is an open market for wholesale power. That's the power that utilities buy and sell among each other. There are a number of points around the country where there's basically a trading hub. The market clears hourly. You can read those market clearing prices in the Wall Street Journal every morning. It is a transparent, open, competitive commodity market, and that exists today.
Can I ask a question?
Sir?
Yeah. Is this due to the Enron factor that happened years back?
This was set up before Enron. You're talking about the Enron debacle of around 2000.
Yeah. Manipulating prices.
Well, they basically took advantage of a poorly designed system in California, and to take advantage of this open market.
But
this is not a result of it. This
pricing structure was in play, or
yes.
This facility was in place prior to that.
Yes.
Why didn't anybody pick up on the transgressions then?
Well, that had to do with how the, that had to do with how the system, the open market system in California, the so-called pilot program, was designed. Okay. And it led them, so it had not had to do with the market. It had to do with how the rules are set up in California.
Okay.
That led to that. Now, but in this market, one thing about this commodity market, unlike most commodity markets, is that it's probably the most volatile commodity market that you can imagine. As a baseline, power may be typically sell for $60 a megawatt hour. It can jump if there's a high supply or high demand, low supply, like at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It can jump quickly to hundreds of dollars, even thousands of dollars a megawatt hour. But by the same token, at night, it can and often does go to zero. It is cheaper for generators to give the power away than it is to spool down their power, especially like a base-loaded plant. It's very expensive to shut down a nuclear plant. They'll give the power away before they want to shut down a plant. So the power often goes to zero, and I try to reflect that here in this graph. You can add on transmission. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, already has tariffs, require utilities to put together tariffs. These are transmitting utilities for transmission tariffs that reflect that the congestion pricing. So right now, utilities are required to have tariffs that allow for transmission of electricity between utilities through their system. And they can put in pricing that reflects congestion. Areas where there's a transmission bottleneck, they can, that's what I try to reflect in that hour 17 there, is a big spike in that transmission price to reflect that either there's not enough transmission capacity, to either try to incentivize them to build more or incentivize them to use it less. Distribution is another cost, but that does not have those similar type of tariffs. That's a pretty much a flat rate for most of the U.S. And then there's something called ancillary services that I could talk about for an hour, but I won't. But the bottom line is that you have this curve. You have this price curve. And the theory is that if you look at it on a locational basis, on a regional, or even right down to the substation, on a substation basis, if you had all that information, the wholesale market, transmission, distribution, and all the services, you could basically have a price curve that reflects what's going on in the grid. And that theory is actually works. It's not, I mean, this is, it's actually a very robust theory because it's an open market, if the pricing was available. The bottom line is that pricing, based on what we call a locational marginal price, should reflect everything that's going on in the grid. So the question is, can you respond to it? Right? And it's something we call real-time pricing. I have a quick slide that doesn't have the same format, so I want to throw this in. There's what we call, there's a different types of price-based demand response programs. There are some utilities that have what they call a time-of-use rate, which is basically a fixed tiered rate based on the time of day to try to roughly reflect what's going on here. Sometimes some utilities have what they call critical peak prices, try to have a high price during that big spike. And then there are a number of utilities have what we call real-time pricing, for especially for large industrials. And remember, we're not talking about open market process here. We're talking about regulated retail prices, but just that you're basing it on this time-of-use basis. Now, I'm going back to this slide. Large industrial users, I'm talking about people who use a lot of electricity, you know, big plants, they've known about this for years. Most utilities have or offer those large industrials what they call a real-time pricing program, usually an hourly-based program, that says, we're going to send you this information, and we're going to let you respond to it. And the idea is that if you can pull back, if the price spikes, and you can respond to that by pulling back on your load, that's going to help us, to help the utilities. By the same token, when the price is low, that's an incentive for that company or that big plant to go all out because the price is cheap. And then so the industrials say, give us that price signal, we'll respond, which will help you, and we'll put a margin on top so you make your money that you need to make. But we want to be able to respond to that pricing signal, and then overall we think we can save money because we're going to use more power when it's cheap, less when it's expensive. That helps the utility because it lowers their peak and helps fill out the valleys. That's been around for decades. The question is, can residentials do this? That is the fundamental question when it comes to demand response. Can a residential load respond to that real-time pricing signal? And the conventional wisdom, the typical answer has typically been no. Homeowners want to use power. They want to flip a switch when they come home, lights come on. They don't want to have to worry about the price of power. We certainly don't expect them to sit in front of the computer all day watching the price of power and trying to respond to that. You know, got to run the dishwasher right now because power is cheap. But that's not what we're talking about here. So what we did at the lab, we put together... we developed a technology and we put together a demonstration where we tested that presumption. We did an experiment up in the Olympic Peninsula just a few years ago. And a report, by the way, was issued to the DOE, and it's available, and I'm more than happy to send you that report or send you a link to it, a 176-page report that talks about this in tremendous detail. What we did is we took 112 homes, and we gave them these three appliances you see on this picture here, a thermostat and a water heater and a dryer that can respond to that market price, that can monitor that price that we send it and do something about it. Now, of course, the thermostat's easy. What the thermostat does is that if the price is high, basically I'm going to set the set point a little bit higher. You know, I'm not going to shut off my heat during winter, but I may raise, or in the case of winter, lower the set point a little bit. In the case of summer, raise the set point a little bit. In the case of the water heater, most people don't care when your water heater runs as long as you got hot water, right? So water heater is a great device to have respond to this. You know, when price is high, turn off your water heater. Dryer is a little bit tougher because if you had a dryer at home and all of a sudden it shut off, who are you going to blame? You're not going to blame the utility. You're going to blame the dryer manufacturer, right? My dryer's broken. So in this case, when we worked with Whirlpool in this case, they developed a dryer where actually the tumbler and the light stayed on, but we just shut the heating element off. And we only shut it off for 5 minutes. So it only extended the drying cycle from 45 minutes, say, to 50 minutes. Let me go back to this. And the whole point of this was to explore whether residential customers, if you automate it, could respond to that real market, real-time pricing. That was the essence of our what we call demand response. This is the essence of the smart grid. Could you have devices in your home that could monitor on an automated basis what's going on in the grid and respond to it? Of course, we had to make it, our view of demand response is that it should, the typical approach to demand response, or the historical one, the easy one, is what we call a command and control, the so-called big red button that the utility has that when times are tight, they press a button and a bunch of water heaters shut off. We believe that demand response should be in the control of customers based on their needs and what they're willing to do. In this particular case, it was a no-lose proposition. They only could save money, but we had to keep it simple. And so, let me go back to this. We actually had, the picture doesn't really reflect it, but we actually had the only control that the end user had was they could choose whether or not they want to have more savings or more comfort. If they chose more comfort, then their appliances just would run normally. But if they wanted to play, they could choose more savings, and the system would aggressively respond. So again, we did this for a year for 112 homes in the Olympic Peninsula. And what we learned from that, first thing, the customers on average saved about 10% on their electric bill. Now think about that for a minute. Is that enough to incentivize most customers to go out and buy this kind of stuff? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe if you live in Hawaii. But probably not if you live in South Central Washington, where we pay 6 cents per kilowatt hour. So that was an interesting fact. They did respond. By the way, the vast majority of customers on this program kind of forgot, you know, it was invisible to them. These devices are designed so that they don't really see the response. But here's the big one. The utility that served those loads saw a 15% reduction in peak load based on during that program. And that's huge. Remember that load duration curve? Can you imagine dropping that top point down 15%? I mean, utilities plan for their peak. And if you could take 15% of that peak away, that would have a huge impact. And that was the analysis that kind of got a lot of attention to demand response, is because it had such a huge opportunity for lowering that peak. Now, does it save energy? I mean, I'll talk about that's a goal, we want to save energy. Actually, not really. It just shifts the load. It shifts that energy usage. You're still going to run your dryer. You're still going to want to heat your home. But you're just going to shift it to a better time that the grid can support it. And that's the whole idea. We even found that we could, as an experiment during the prior period, we actually forced to try to see if we could drop that demand by 50%, not just 15%, and see if we could do it. And we were able to do that for up to 3 days before what we call response fatigue set in, and people got tired of their house being a little cooler and actually said, okay, I want to go back to more comfort. But it's amazing the ability that this type of system had to control. And it's all based on responding to these prices. Now, what happened after the Olympic Peninsula, that was a few years ago. One of the criticisms we had, well, you only have 112 homes up in the Olympic Peninsula. Is that really an accurate assessment? Well, one of the big ARRA projects that came through the Department of Energy was to fund 16 large regional smart grid demonstrations. The two, the largest of those, by the way, is right here in the Pacific Northwest, called the Pacific Northwest Smart Grid Demonstration Project. It's operated out of our lab. We're the center. Involves 5 states, 11 utilities, 60,000 customers. We'll get a much better answer after that. That is being engineered right now. It should be up and running, I think, in early or in spring of 2012 and run for a couple of years. That's the largest of the 16. The second largest is in American Electric Power System in Columbus, Ohio. They're also going to use PNNL's demand response technology because the reason why is because PNNL, I may mention this, is operated by a company called Battelle out of Columbus, Ohio, and so we have a connection with AEP there. So the two largest of the 16 regional demonstration programs are going to use this price-based demand response. I'm going to skip this issue, so I'm going to get back to that. But let me talk a couple of issues about smart grid, because I've got a few more minutes. One of them is talk about CO2 emissions. We did an analysis that said, okay, what is just doing just demand response? If we had just demand response as a tool, what would that impact be on CO2 emissions? And the answer was we could reduce CO2 emissions by 12% just with demand response. That's a pretty big chunk. This is my favorite one. I mentioned this already, the impact of EVs on the power grid. And again, I mentioned that we can get 73% of cars could be put on the grid, again, if you charge smartly using these type of technologies. Now, I just want to mention one other aspect. Now, I'm going to show this is going to, don't mean to get surprised by this graph, but I have to point out one other thing. When we talk about demand response, responding to a real-time price is one aspect of it. Another aspect is an autonomous measurement. If we have a real-time pricing, there's still going to be a lag, right? There's still going to be about a 5-minute lag. By the way, the real-time pricing program we did on our technology is a 5-minute clearing price. It sends that signal every 5 minutes. We also developed a technology where the devices can respond instantaneously by monitoring frequency. And the best way to do that is with devices that are inherently energy storage devices. And the two that come to mind are, first of all, electric vehicles, right? I mean, they store energy in the car. The other one is water heaters. Water heaters are energy storage devices. They store that energy in the form of water, hot water in a tank. Well, we have technology, and this is something that's being deployed, where we can respond to frequency on a real-time basis. Now, that top chart there is showing the frequency, which normally, as you know, is normally 60 hertz for North America. That frequency, remember, think of the electric grid like a big machine. Every time you put on a new load, that machine slows down. It's just like driving your car up a hill. When you take away some of the demand, it speeds up. Well, that change in frequency, that frequency fluctuates constantly. And that graph here is a real graph we pulled out. And these are minutes on the bottom scale. So that's only about a 12-minute scale. And you can see that the frequency is changing constantly. The big blue line is kind of an average frequency. Well, we designed a system that we can take that load on EVs or water heaters, and actually you can do it with other appliances too, and base your operation in a real time based on that frequency. So in this case, that red line on the bottom graph, that one, is basically the charging of the electric vehicle in response to that frequency. And so it charges a little bit slower, not quite a linear line, but it charges that car a little bit slower to get to 100% charge based on that frequency. And the reason I spend the time talking about that is that in addition to price-based, these types of demand response technologies can basically provide the utility the ability to provide what they call balancing services. Remember way back in the beginning, I talked about how utilities have to balance supply and load on a minute-to-minute basis? Right now, they do that with usually natural gas generators or other baseload generators. And Pacific Northwest do a lot with hydro. We did a study that just came out a couple weeks ago, and that's why I want to mention this. We did an analysis that found that if 10% of the vehicles in the Pacific Northwest were electric today, it could provide all the balancing requirements for the Pacific Northwest just with demand. And that's amazing. I mean, you wouldn't have to use generators to provide balancing services. You could do it with demand. And that's the takeaway that I want to talk to you about demand response. Demand response is in smart grid is all about turning demand into a resource rather than it's something that you always have to try to meet. You can use demand as a resource to handle grid and to do a lot of things that utilities aren't doing today in ways that are far, far cheaper and a lot better for the environment. So a couple of just issues. I mean, like a lot of other things, technology and you always hear about technology, something that moves faster than the policy to catch up. SmartGrid is no exception. The technology is basically available, but most of the technologies that we developed at the lab could not be implemented today because we simply don't have the regulatory structures to do so, you know, given the existing structure. That doesn't mean that it's it can't fit. It's just that we need policy to support what we're the technology. The market structure and regulatory policy impacts our technology development. So there's policy solutions that have to go on to support this technology, just so we can deploy these for the benefit of the grid. And that's why I'm always looking for the opportunity to talk to groups like yours.
So, thank you.
And I'm probably talking very fast.
Yeah. Excellent. And even though this is the second time I've heard it, it's just as compelling and fascinating as the first time I heard it about a month ago. So first I'm going to see if there's any questions, and then we have quite a few other speakers that are going to be discussing this. Questions? Mr. Christensen, no? Okay. Thank you very much. We have copies of your PowerPoint presentation that we're going to send out to the committee members.
Okay.
I'm hoping you can stay for the rest of the presentations in case there's some other questions, and I know we'll be doing some follow-up.
Okay.
But thank you again for
thank you very much.
Coming here today. All right. Committee members, we're going to hear from, actually, we have four different utility perspectives that we're going to hear from today, both in the public and private sector. And then the closing panel will be, we have John Savage from the Public Utility Commission and Michael Young from Smart Grid Oregon, because I think part of what Mr. Christensen said in his, one of his points in his presentation is, and obviously we're policymakers, are there some policies that we need to look at to make sure that we're moving in the right direction and promoting Smart Grid? And I think it'll be interesting to hear from both the PUC and Smart Grid Oregon on that. But first, we have PG and PacifiCorp that I'm going to ask to come up together. It's always fun to have rivals up here together. And then we'll have Eugene Water and Electric Board, and we have Oregon Rural Electric Cooperatives that will come up afterwards. So first we're going to hear from the private perspective, and then we'll hear from the public perspective. So thank you both for being here today.
Good morning, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I represent Portland General Electric. PGE serves approximately 825,000 customers in 52 cities over 4,000 square miles. Thank you for the opportunity to present PGE's perspective and our ongoing work related to Smart Grid. Part of the challenge of Smart Grid is defining it in a way that stakeholders can agree upon its meaning. It means different things to different people. It's not a single concept or a single technology. PGE's working definition of Smart Grid is leveraging technology and communication to automate generation, transmission, distribution systems with one or more of the following goals: improving system reliability, improving system asset utilization, lowering operating costs, and providing customers with information and alternatives to save energy and lower their carbon footprint. We've been working for years to deliver Smart Grid solutions to our customers. Many of our accomplishments are notable in the industry and to our stakeholders, but aren't really evident to consumers at large. For example, we've been have an ongoing program to upgrade all of our substations with SCADA-level telemetry, which improves communications. One of the foundations to deliver Smart Grid technologies is the smart meter. We have now fully implemented smart meters in our service territory. Planning through implementation was about a 15-year process. Most of that was planning for it. It was about 2 years to install the smart meters throughout the service territory. We've had a good experience with our smart meter installation that hasn't necessarily been true for other utilities across the country that have done this. There's a number of videos circulating on the internet and people raising concerns about security and privacy and things of that nature. After the rollout was complete, we did some additional research and found that our customers didn't really know very much about the smart meter and the smart grid. A vast majority of them wanted us to move forward on implementing it, but when we dug a little deeper, we found that 32% of our customers claimed that they had smart meters, which was about equal to the 31% who acknowledged having a meter at all. So now that we have smart meters, what's next? Those are opening two-way communication lines and allowing new choices for customers. PG is beginning to deliver customers expanded pricing options, preferred due dates, and energy monitoring tools. I'll go through some of the programs that we're working on. Most of them are pilot stage at this point, but they should sound familiar based on the last presentation that you just heard. Energy Partner is an automated demand response program. It's managed by RTP Controls, where customers work with PGE to reduce load and lower their energy costs by reducing their use when demand is particularly high, as we heard with trying to deal with the peaks. Examples of energy reduction strategies include reducing lighting levels, shifting HVAC set points, and things of that nature. We expect the program will reduce energy demand by up to 50 megawatts of capacity. Flex Price is a voluntary two-year pilot involving approximately 1,000 customers. It's our critical peak pricing program. Customers pay different rates for peak periods, and this is essentially the sort of bucket approach that was explained in the last presentation. The pilot will help us understand a little bit more about customers' interest in participating in this and the level of response we'll get to critical events. Energy Tracker is a new program that we'll be launching later this year. It's an online tool for homeowners to set up their own profile online so that they can understand how they are spending their energy dollars and what actions they might take to reduce their usage. We are participating in the Pacific Northwest Smart Grid Demonstration Project that was discussed in the last panel. PGE's role in the project is our Salem Smart Power Pilot Program. This involved about 600 residential and business customers in Salem. Design and construction is underway, and we'll focus on four main objectives. The first is testing energy storage. We're going to install a 5-megawatt battery storage system capable of peak reduction, wind balancing, solar balancing, and supplying emergency backup power during a potential blackout. Creating a high reliability zone to limit the impact of outages. We're going to modify a 13-kilovolt feeder to demonstrate self-healing capability, intentional islanding to isolate it from the rest of the grid and use the resources within that feeder location should there be an outage. Demonstrate demand response. We're going to focus the Energy Partner program that I spoke about previously on business customers within the demonstration area. We're also going to install residential water heater controllers to allow reductions during peak power cost times using power system conditions supplied by Battelle, as you heard in the last presentation. And finally, coordinate real-time solutions for the regional power issues by linking the Salem Energy Storage distributed generation and demand response systems with Battelle's demonstration of a transactive control system. And finally, we have a ongoing dispatchable standby generation program. This puts large customers' generation to work for up to 400 hours annually to meet power demands. In exchange, PG picks up the cost for maintenance and fuel for those generators, which are always available to back up the customer's facility and operate in parallel with PGE's system. We have about 53 megawatts currently available in reserve dispatch with about another 37 megawatts under construction. You'll hear more about it later, but PGE is also participating in Smart Grid Planning Docket, currently before the PUC. It's brought to light a number of issues that will need to be addressed. Access and use of customer information is a very critical issue we need to work through. There's some concern about ensuring that we don't make premature policy decisions as we're continuing to learn through these pilots about how we can integrate these things into our system and interoperability and data security. So we have significant work underway related to the smart grid, but managing expectations is important at this stage in smart grid development. There's a lot of opportunities, but it's not something we can just flip on with a switch. There's a lot of testing and analysis that needs to be done on our system and how to integrate these technologies. As I said, many of our projects are at a pilot stage that will allow us to gather information, provide learning to inform future policy decisions, and to help determine which products or services are best suited for our system. Unlike other investments, Smart Grid Technologies must show a business case for a project or investment to move forward. And, you know, as we work through these technical issues and these pilot programs, we'll learn more and be able to judge best how to move forward at that time. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. I'm going to have Scott go next, but one thing that I'm going to ask you, and I'll ask Scott as well, maybe you can respond at the end, is we had heard from Mr. Christensen's presentation that the pilot project, they found about a 15% saving or reduction in the load. So I'm going to be curious to see if you have, or you're setting goals for your pilot program. I didn't hear a specific target number, so maybe you can, after Scott's done, maybe you can both talk about that. Scott? Writing down your homework assignment.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Committee members, my name is Scott Bolton, representing PacifiCorp. PacifiCorp serves over 1.7 million customers across six western states. We serve Oregon as Pacific Power and serving about 550,000 customers all across the state. We're mostly a rural power company outside of Senator Dingfelder's district. Thanks for the opportunity to give you a brief update on PacifiCorp's experience with smart grid technologies. While the term smart grid is relatively new, the concepts that help define smart grid, and you've heard about already this morning, greater efficiency through technology, increased reliability and security of the system, and better system communication, have been around for a while and are basic elements of PacifiCorp's system for a couple decades now. Many of these features have been designed into our distribution systems as well as the transmission level and have provided customer benefit while also giving the company and our asset engineering group a platform to evaluate new technologies as they come on and evaluate their costs and benefits. The company currently is looking at developing upgrades to existing network control systems. That would be our SCADA system, which is really the network operations center, really the war room that really lets us know what's going on with the grid at all times. We're constantly looking at ways to improve SCADA capability and also looking at voltage conservation reduction measures, similar to some of the ideas that were mentioned earlier in the PNNL presentation. And using that lexicon, those are really supply-side investments. Those are using technology to help solve problems and find greater reliability and efficiency on the supply side and managing our system. I think the current debate and where a lot of focus is now is on the demand side and on customer metering technologies. This is an area we've spent a lot of time and focus on and trying to figure out ways to make investments to capture benefits of newer technologies. Something that we haven't really gotten into in any of the presentations is currently there are a couple of different competing technologies, and maybe not even competing as much as just different approaches to customer metering. There's the AMI technology, which PGE has fully implemented, which a number of utilities in California have also integrated into their systems. We've chosen to invest in AMR technology, which is automated meter reading. It's a mobile-based system. We found that it works very well for a rural service territory. In evaluating each technology, our criteria is pretty straightforward and simple. It's got to be cost-effective. It has to solve identifiable operational issues. And you have to have some public policy or regulatory support for that upgrade and investment because we are talking about significant deployment of capital. As a result, we expect to fully roll out AMR meter upgrades in Utah, Wyoming, and Washington by the end of this year. For us, the benefits are pretty clear. We see the installed costs of this technology be about 25% of what AMI is per unit. So especially over a less dense service territory, that's a significant savings and makes a lot of sense. The business case, so basically the payback for these investments are relatively short. We anticipate that the payback will be within 7 years for Washington and Wyoming, and in Utah, where we have a much more urban, more dense service territory, we expect the payback for that investment to be in 4.5 years.
And Scott, just a quick follow-up. Is the payback on deferred costs of building additional generation, or is it not having to meet that peak demand?
No, it's really much more the operational savings as far as reduced labor, back office support costs, IT costs, those kinds of things. The technology, as I just mentioned, is consistent with our customer support systems. Again, we're an integrated utility serving six different states, so having a common back office system for billing and customer service and outage awareness and all those technical things makes sense to be the one system serving all those jurisdictions. This works well with those current capabilities. And we also see AMR technology providing many of the same functionalities as the AMI technology. And one of the things, and this is an important point, is we're starting to see more applications being developed to take advantage of both technologies. So one thing that you're not going to hear is that the utilities have all the answers as far as the customer experience or what benefits will ultimately be gained out of these metering technologies. But these answers are out there in the marketplace where software developers and different technologists are figuring out how can you make these energy decisions more relevant and more beneficial for the consumer end use. We haven't made a final determination yet on the deployment of AMR technology in Oregon. We think there's a strong business case. We're currently still looking at that, and we anticipate that within the next couple months we'll make a final call on whether we will roll out AMR metering in Oregon or not. Thanks for the opportunity. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both, and I guess I'll go back to the question I asked before and about do you have set targets for savings comparable to what was demonstrated for the pilot project from P&L. And Mary, I don't know if you have the answer to that or can get back to us.
For our Energy Partner Program, which is the automated demand response program, we're expecting that we'll have about 50 megawatts of capacity.
So what percentage is that?
So it's maybe about, when you add that, you have maybe about 5% of the load. But again, a lot of our programs are at pilot stage, and so we're going to learn a lot about customer interest and participation in the program and things of that nature. So until we get some of that feedback from the pilots, it's going to be hard to project if we were to roll out a program more fully, what kind of response we would get and what kind of percentage reduction in the peak load we would see.
Hey, Scott?
I think to answer your question, as far as energy savings targeted based on metering technology upgrades, I don't think we have, I will double check, I don't think we have an energy savings target. We've really looked at these investments more on a dollar and cents basis. Is there an economic savings target? And that's essentially what we've looked at in deploying this metering technology. Again, being able to have a new technology that is going to reduce labor costs, is going to reduce back office support, those kinds of things are really what drove those investment decisions for us. I'll also say, though, that metering and that real-time customer interface is an emerging and I think a really promising area to find additional energy savings. But it's only one tool in a whole suite of demand response tools in the toolbox that we use. And so some of the other approaches that were mentioned earlier, as far as time of use tariffs, working with large customers, when we have peak events or we have system constraints to be able to go to large energy users and basically pay them to ramp down, those are programs that have been in existence for quite a while. And those do have considerable energy savings and do help us shave peak and be able to meet load requirements without having to continually overbuild or create more capacity than is really needed.
All right, thank you. We'll see if there's any questions from any of the members of the committee. Senator?
Ms. Haynes, on your energy tracker program,
mm-hmm.
you said you can get on the internet and look to see your energy usage. Do you track through your smart meters, do you track the usage on the home and you can tell them what they're doing, or is this a program that shows them how to reduce their usage?
It will give them information on what their energy use levels are so that they can see if it is an expensive time of day. They could maybe make their own adjustments, but it's basically just a tool that they can sign up for voluntarily to provide them information. It would also give them recommendations for things that they could do to adjust their energy usage and save money.
Is it real time? Is it real time?
It uses interval data, so I'm not sure
there's lag time.
You know, if there's like the 5 minute that was discussed, I could get back to you on that.
Follow up. Along those same lines, and do you track with your smart meters everybody's home as to exactly their peak uses of energy, or is this something when you sign up, then you'd begin tracking it through the smart meter? And does the smart meter do that?
The smart meter collects that data.
Okay.
You know, it's not something that we don't go and look at everybody's home. I mean, we're looking at system level things, but we do think that for some of our customers, they will appreciate the tool of being able to look at their own information.
Follow up. Because one of the considerations, I've had constituents talk to me about smart meters, and they're concerned that if the load peaks, that you can cut them off.
Yeah.
You can turn their meter down a little bit, so.
No.
That won't happen, will it?
That will not happen. All of our programs are voluntary.
Okay.
Scott, did you want to follow up?
Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, one of the demand response programs that we have in Utah is a program called Cool Keeper. And so customers voluntarily sign up to have basically a signal box on their air conditioning. And so during times of congestion or we have a peak demand event, we are able to remotely be able to turn down those air conditioning units and be able to shave significant amounts of usage. But again, it's a customer voluntary program where they receive basically a rebate or a benefit on their bill for participating in the program.
And
those have worked well.
They've signed up for it, and they understand that would happen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And when that happens, it's usually a few degrees on the thermostat. It's not turning anybody off in a heat wave.
Unless it's an outage of the entire system.
Right. That's a barbarian to the gate.
Yes.
Ms. Haynes, is this your energy tracker? Is this already published by PGE? People, if you went to your website, you could find that?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, it's not. It will be launched later this year.
Okay.
Are you in PGE territory?
Yeah, I'm in PGE
territory. There you go. Well, so make sure and alert Senator Olson as soon as it's online.
My lights go off. I'm talking to you.
Yeah. Any other questions?
No comments either.
Okay. Or comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we're going to hear from eWeb. We have... Let's see, Greg Armistead, and we also have Ted Case. So now we're going to hear the public utility perspective. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming today, and whoever wants to go first.
That's pretty cool. I thought it was a beer tap. Oh.
Good morning. I guess I've been drafted to go first. Chair Dingfelder's members of the committee, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. OREECA represents 18 electric co-ops in Oregon, serving 200,000 consumers, 30,000 miles of line. Appreciate the opportunity to testify here today. I'm here to say that Oregon electric co-ops are making very exciting investments in smart grid, smart meter systems. These AMI advanced metering system, which is the two-way systems, have a range of capabilities contributing to lower operating costs and improved service. Recently, we had three electric co-ops invest in smart meters through a 50% grant from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which is the stimulus plan, the Recovery Act. We are on target for approximately 130,000 smart meters in homes around the state of Oregon. And recently, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission concluded that electric cooperatives lead the country in the deployment of smart meters with about 25% penetration. You've heard about some of the advantages of these smart meters from Marion. Increased reliability, cost savings, and readiness for demand-side management programs. And I think the most important point for us is these are very important tools for very remote and rural electric systems that don't have very large staffs. And let me just give you a couple examples of that. Some of the benefits include outage management, to your point, Senator Dingfelter. This helps us get information quickly so that the cooperative can shorten the duration of the outage. To enable consumers to monitor their electricity usage on their computer or even their phone. We're finding folks are very interested in this, and generally we're about a day behind, Senator Olson, to get that information, but they do call, they check their phone, and once they have that tool, they find it's a very fascinating and empowering tool. The ability to control the meter from the office, for instance, Lane Electric, which is in Senator Prezanski's district, they do not need to send a crew 60 miles up to McKinsey to connect a consumer. They can do it just from the home office, which saves a lot of trips and a lot of truck traffic. And the ability to set up prepaid programs, which we're finding very interesting and a very popular program for those customers that have some credit issues, can't make a large deposit. They use the smart meters and this capability to pay for electricity much like they have with gas. They pay for it in advance for $50, and they draw that down, and when they're getting low, they put more in rather than get a bill at the end of the month. Mid-State Electric, which is located in Lapine, Oregon, they have 470 people on this prepaid program. They just started that in March. So there are many capabilities, and frankly, we are continuing to learn each day about some of those capabilities and some of the different things that we can do. I think the key issue for this committee is, you know, we have done this without any mandates, without anybody telling us to do it. We do it because it makes good business sense. It's good for our members, and we take the security and privacy issues very, very seriously. There's a lot of stuff, as Marion Haynes said, on the Internet going around. Generally, we can deal with those by having the consumer come in and talk to us, but we're not selling any information or anything like that, and there's no health issues along with that. So it's a very exciting opportunity, and we're learning more about it. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you, Ted. Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll take questions from the panel.
Good morning, Senator Dingfelter, committee members. My name is Greg Armstead. I represent the Eugene Water and Electric Board. Says I'm a project manager in charge of our advanced metering infrastructure project down there, and we probably lag most of the utilities you've heard from so far a little bit, so some of my information probably will just repeat what they do, and I'll try and avoid that. As the largest municipal utility in Oregon, we pretty much approach it from the consumer side, the consumer perspective, or the demand side. We don't have a lot of supply. We don't have a lot of transmission to worry about. So our focus is on our issues around our consumer acceptance and what they will actually be able to really utilize in terms of energy savings and cost savings. We have several pilots underway right now. We have a pilot, what we call an energy information program, which involves a small number of smart meters, putting them in customer homes, and then giving them access to web portals and other tools that allow them to see their energy use. Our interest there really is to find out, will they actually use that information? Will they actually modify their behavior, and in which ways? And will that basically enable them to save money or save power? We also have a water heater program that's basically integrated with wind renewable integration and information, basically controls the water heaters and uses them as that storage device that was talked about a little bit earlier. That's part of what we do down in Eugene. We have a couple pilots coming up in 2012. This is a couple of demand response programs, again targeted at the consumer, not so much commercial or industrial loads, but more just residential consumers. And we are looking at prepay, rolling that out as a pilot test in 2012. Our programs are really designed to find out, for us, you know, time of use pricing. I think you've heard about that. You've heard about critical peak pricing, those kinds of things. We're really trying to find out what kind of savings can occur, and if consumers can accrue those savings in their own home, then how does that accrue to the utility as a total? With 80,000 customers, the theory, I think, is if everybody can save a little bit of power at the right times, then everybody benefits as a community, and everybody benefits kind of translates into reduced carbon emissions, can translates into reduced total cost to the community for purchase power prices. And we believe, in theory, that this will be a good match with the consumer values that we find in our community. We have to prove that, you know, we've seen. I think what we saw is some pilot information that suggested that consumers could yield up to 10%. We kind of consider that probably a high end or a best case scenario. We're kind of more interested in finding out if you do that with a large number of people, what exactly will be the experience. Maybe it'll be 10%, maybe it'll be 5%. We really don't know that, and that's information I think we're going to look to collect over the next couple of years. Concerns that we're hearing from our consumers are around safety and health. There's a growing concern around the kind of communications that need to occur for these meters. And for the devices on distribution systems to communicate back to the utility, probably a wireless access point somewhere in this room. That's radio frequency technology. All of our computers have wireless devices, and there's a lot of consumer sentiment that wireless technology represents some yet unproven but concerned about health concerns. There's concerns about privacy. I think that people begin to feel like a smart meter that measures their consumption at fairly granular levels allows the utility to spy on them. Not that we would necessarily want to do that, but if people are concerned about that, that will raise opposition, that will raise fears, and those kinds of people are probably not going to want to participate in the program, and they will not enjoy the benefits that we're looking at, and then the community's benefit will likewise be reduced. There are concerns in other utility jurisdictions. We haven't run into them yet around accuracy. What we find is a lot of utilities, and we're in that boat too, our meters are mechanical in nature right now, and they're fairly old, and they tend to run a little slow, which means that if you live in Eugene, chances are you have a 30-year-old meter that's under-registering what your actual electricity usage is. You put a new meter on your home, smart or otherwise, you may find that we're actually going to end up billing you more because we'll be more accurately metering your consumption. And that can provoke some unwanted responses from customers. There are some cost equity issues involved. We talk about demand response and trying to move consumer consumption of energy out of like the 5 o'clock time period, which tends to be a peak time, particularly in the summer, or out of the 8 in the morning time period, which tends to be a peak time in the winter. A lot of businesses who are the largest consumers of energy can't move their energy consumption. That's when their business occurs. And so they sometimes will raise their hands and suggest that they become losers in this endeavor. And probably everything else would be just a repeat of what everybody else said, and so I'll spare you that.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these gentlemen? Senator Przanski?
I have a question for Greg. I know that you put out a request for, I think, 100 homes to volunteer, and my wife was going to sign us up. Do you know if we actually got signed up?
Oh, good.
I would. If I were you, I would monitor this guy.
Yeah, the chair says it's already happening. I'm glad that you're here in black today. You know, with a helicopter and everything.
That wasn't really a question. No, just kidding.
Not so far.
Yeah. Well,
so
has the program been? Have you had success in the sense of getting the people signed up that want to be participating?
Yes, Chairman Dinkfelder and Senator Przanski. We just started that collection of information from folks just, I think, 10, 15 days ago, and we've gotten a pretty good response. We're looking for 100 consumers spread out throughout our service territory, and we've got about half of those identified already.
I'll find out if we got signed up or not.
Yeah, and I think
I'm sure you'll be hearing from the senator.
I think that'll be another week
today.
Or 10 days down the road before everybody's notified.
Yeah.
Senator Thompson, do you have a question?
Senator Przanski's probably going to go home and check. He might have one of those old meters. He might not want to sign up.
He may be one of the ones benefiting from the system. Any questions down on this end? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate the information today and sharing the work that you're doing. And last but not least, to wrap up this presentation, we have John Savage from the Public Utility Commission. And I'm going to ask Michael Young to come up. Is Michael here?
Yes.
From Smart Grid Oregon. And I've been jotting down some notes, so I have quite a few questions for you. And maybe while she's setting it up, I'll put this out here because I'm hoping you can help address some of these, John. One of the questions I had jotted down was based on Mr. Christensen's presentation, if utilities are required to include time of use pricing as part of their IRP. I don't know the answer to that, so that is one. Also on smart grid technologies, if that is currently required as part of the ARP, or that's something you're going to talk about, the flexibility.
I'm going to talk about both.
And then last but not least, WEC, because I know you're very involved with WEC, and unfortunately we don't have the staff to do that and attend ourselves, if there are consistent smart grid policies that are being considered among the WEC states, and any recommendation that you gentlemen might have to us as policymakers. So that's sort of the, like to hear your
Thank you. Madam Chair, for members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Savage with the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Oh, I got it right. I'm going to cover four topics. I'm going to go very quickly over the first two because Mr. Christensen and others have talked about what is the smart grid, but I think it's worth hearing four times. And I talk about the potential
benefits. Maybe we'll remember it.
Yeah, well, I mean, just saying, it's, for me, I find that this is really useful that I have to hear it again and again. Potential benefits of smart grid investments, but what I'm going to focus on is what have we done at the commission and what are we currently doing?
I know you read my mind, John.
Yeah. So as you've heard, the smart grid, I'm going to throw out my definition, refers to a suite of technologies and applications that allow us to prove the control and operation of the power system at all levels. Three basic components. One, two-way real-time digital communication between a utility and a site, say a customer home. Two, smart devices that monitor, measure, collect, send, and act on the digital information. And three, advanced controls that use the information for a wide variety of beneficial purposes. For example, Mr. Christensen talked about visualization, the ability to see the whole grid instantaneously. That is the type of beneficial use that you get with advanced controls and smart grid technologies. Now, for our own simple-minded purposes at the Commission, we divide it into two types of technologies. One, at the technologies at the transmission and distribution system level, kind of the grid level, and then technologies at the customer level, such as two-way meters and the smart appliances that can signal back and forth from the utility. Okay, the next two slides show benefits. I'm not going to dwell on these, but let me highlight a few from our standpoint. Reduce time and cost to detect system problems, which would allow us to fix them and then prevent outages. I think this is very key. This is one of the big money savers from smart grid. Two, faster restoration of service if there's an outage. Reduce cost of meter reading and billing, which we've been talking about with the AMR and the AMI discussion. And a huge one is the enhanced ability to save energy and reduce peak demand by giving customers more timely real-time customer usage. So what have we done? PGE and Idaho Power have installed two-way advanced meters. This is AMI for their Oregon customers, and these are foundational smart grid investments at the customer level. In 2007, PGE filed to install advanced meters for its customers. We thoroughly evaluated their application, and we improved it solely based on expected benefits to customers from operational savings alone. We didn't even get into any of the benefits from demand response or some of the other benefits potential. We only looked at it from operational. We attached 12 pages of conditions to our approval. And these conditions include regular reporting on the installation customer response. We did not want to recreate what had happened in California. It was ugly down there. Conducting a voluntary critical peak pricing pilot, which Ms. Haynes has talked about, implementing a program to encourage large users to reduce use when demand is high, and developing plans using interval data and system status to reduce transformer failures, to size transformers right, to delay work on power line conductors, to reduce trouble calls, and to identify system faults faster, among other actions. So we have a slew of requirements that we put on PG, and they're systematically going through those requirements. Other actions, as I mentioned, Idaho Power has replaced conventional meters with advanced meters for most of its 18,000 customers in Oregon. We've required Pacific and PGE to evaluate and install measures to improve the efficiency of its distribution systems. We sponsored two workshops a couple of years ago to hear from national experts and discuss some of the alternative visions of the future, some of the visions that Mr. Christensen put forward, and identify technical and regulatory issues we needed to address. We also established a policy to require utilities to consider a smart grid investment when they are considering a more conventional technology investment. So the sponsored workshops that I mentioned have led into a smart grid policy docket, and the point of that docket is to sort of establish smart grid policies and planning requirements for our utilities. And to date, staff and parties have explored a wide range of issues on this, and in May we issued an interim order setting forth four directives. One, we require the utilities to report on the status of their current and planned smart grid investments and projects, sort of find out where they are and where they are going as they see it right now, and we will be getting those reports soon. We directed our commission staff to report on technologies and applications and practices and investments that are being made by utilities throughout the United States. We wanted to see what the state of the art is. We've also told our staff to go and do issue-oriented workshops on key issues that you've heard some of them, such as cybersecurity, interoperability requirements, and the role of utilities in home energy management, such as the energy trackers, which PGE mentioned. We also moved a discussion of time-varying pricing and all these wonderful pricing that you're hearing. Think of the whole universe of them as prices that vary by time. Different times, whether it's hourly, seasonally, daily. And that's what we're talking about in terms of time-varying pricing. So by the end of the year, we're going to hold a summary workshop that's going to air the results from all the issue workshops, and then from here, hear from the companies and staff and information. The upshot of it will be an order, sort of our decision-making, instrument is called an order that'll set forth policy and planning guidelines and requirements for our utilities. And I'm guessing end of year, roughly, maybe next year. Let me mention two other dockets. One gets right into the heart of pricing, and that we have a docket that's looking at evaluating use of pricing that varies by time. We're looking at voluntary. We're looking at if we ever did mandatory. We're not saying we'll ever do mandatory, which has raised some issues. What standards would we use for determining what's a good pricing program or not? And again, the two-way smart meters allow this to happen for some of these pricing because we're getting interval data at much smaller, nearer to the time of usage. We also have a docket that's looking at all our policies that we want to put in place for anticipating the advent of electric vehicles. And again, as Mitch Christensen pointed out, sort of the vision down the road is using our car batteries actually to bolster our grid. Now, this is a few years away. They did a sort of a halfway approach where you can use the car batteries as a source of demand if they're charging at the right time. If we've got too much wind blowing, and then the wind, that's the source of demand now for the wind. So that was one of their studies that they have done. Let me end quickly with three observations. As you can see, we've been involved in this some time, and we're really looking into it. These investments hold significant promise. I mean, there really is some great potential down the road. They're very difficult to evaluate at times. The issues are evolving, cybersecurity. Sometimes it's hard to figure out the benefits, like from pricing options. You know, we're still somewhat in the infant stage. Very important. Two, our standard, as was mentioned, for the utilities is, for any investment by our utilities, will the benefits to our customers outweigh the cost to our customers? Third observation is we do expect our utilities to be continuing evaluating these technologies and applications, developing plans for investments in a collaborative process, and seeking out investments that enhance service and yield benefits to our customers. Let me talk about requirements at the IRP level. One of the issues in our pricing dockets is we want some kind of systematic evaluation of these as a resource. We threw out doing it in the IRP. Some people push back just in terms of our ability to do that in an IRP, but we would be looking at some format, some systematic way that the utilities will be looking at this as a resource. So that getting to your heart of real-time pricing and some demand response, we already require them to look at. We think that's a resource. We want to make sure they're tapping all the cost-effective demand response they can. I still think we need a lot of pilot programs, and we need to continue to push and stage this stuff and be aggressive, but not overly too unduly costly. At the WEC level, the WEC is the Western Electricity Coordinating Council. If you go back to Mr. Christensen's slide, there's three big coordinating councils that balance all demand and supply in those three areas. You've got Texas, you've got the East, and you've got the West. At the WEC level, one of the things they applied, let me tell you, one of the things they're doing is they applied for a major ARRA federal grant to install what are called synchrophasers, which allow two main areas. Let me just point two areas that they're doing. One is the synchrophasers, which allow previously, I think they were getting information on the system status every 2 seconds. Now you're getting every 30th of a second.
Massive.
I mean, it's just that you can't, and when you're looking at the type of outage that it's occurring, you need that instantaneous kind of information and the ability to respond, and no human being can do it, and 2 seconds is way too long. It just doesn't happen. This is why things flip so hard, so fast, if we don't have our systems in place for those kinds of major cascading outages. The other thing they're looking at is this real-time visualization where that you can have instantaneous visualization, you know, sort of a look at the whole system simultaneously, again, which would help avert outages, detect problems, and the like. So those are some of the things that are happening at the WEC level. Okay.
You answered all my questions.
Okay. Fine,
but why don't we hear from Mr. Young, and then we'll see if there's other questions.
Good morning. Thank
you. Good morning.
You.
Thank Chair you Dingfelder, for being here.
Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Michael Jung. I'm here today representing an organization you may not have heard of before called Smart Grid Oregon. I will also be informed by my experiences as the policy director for a company called Silver Spring Networks that works in the smart grid space, and also have some perspectives to share as a former energy advisor to the previous governor of Oregon, Ted Strickland. Smart Grid Oregon, we're the new kids on the block. We were founded early last year, but in a very short period of time, we have garnered significant interest. We have about 44 members, member organizations, and over 150 participants from those member organizations have participated in our various events over this past year. To put it nicely, I think we came at the right time for the right issue at the right place. Smart Grid Oregon has a two-pronged mission. The first is to serve as a bit of a policy think tank, to come up with the ideas and to advocate for those good ideas so that we can move forward in Oregon with the development of a smart grid infrastructure and a business environment in a logical and sustainable fashion. In addition to serving as a bit of a policy think tank, we also view ourselves as a trade organization, a catalyst, if you will, for entrepreneurs, for innovators, for businesses in Oregon that are interested in capitalizing upon the economic opportunity that the smart grid represents. The electric industry in the United States, about $300 billion every year is spent on electricity. It is in many ways considered the mother of all industries. And so to get even a small share, our proportionate share, or if we're lucky, our disproportionate share of that industry as it modernizes through Oregon innovation and entrepreneurism is our goal as well. So we're bringing people together across Oregon to connect, to network, and to find those opportunities to capitalize upon the smart grid. To put things into perspective, you heard a lot of fascinating testimony on what is the smart grid, how does it work, what benefits will it deliver. I'd like to put it into a little bit of context. I'd like to think that today in the smart grid is kind of like 1990 in the Internet. 1990 in the Internet, people were starting to talk about it, people were starting to imagine it, but no one yet had really built the Internet. The infrastructure was in place. The pipes that carry the data were starting to come online. But the first web browser hadn't really been released at large scale. Email was only a very rudimentary tool at the time. But already at that time, entrepreneurs, innovators, were starting to dream up and starting to build the businesses that became the Googles and the Amazons and the eBays and the Netscapes, the companies that transformed an entire industry. They did it through innovation. They did it by being early on that curve. We'd like to see Oregon come up with those innovators, come up with those entrepreneurs who are able to build those equivalents for the smart grid industry. How do we get there? First, I would break down the smart grid into roughly two pieces. There's the hardware and then there's the software. The hardware is the infrastructure, the physical infrastructure. We've heard mention of synchrophases. We've heard mention of smart meters. There are entire categories of devices. In many ways, it might be useful to think of the smart grid as essentially the networking together through communications and information technology of all the things on the grid, of all the things that generate, deliver, manage, monitor, and consume electricity. If we're networking those things all together, we're building that hardware, that infrastructure for the smart grid. But as we all know with computers, if you buy a computer, the hardware doesn't do anything in and of itself. The smart grid, in many ways, is kind of the ultimate means. What are the ends? On top of that hardware, we need applications. And applications are things like smart metering, things like outage detection and management, processes that take advantage of that infrastructure. Those processes can be built on software, but they also require extensive business process change within utilities. And these are challenges. It will require some degree, some believe revolutionary, some would argue evolutionary, but everyone agrees that there will be change required in the business models for the smart grid to really succeed. Business models not only for utilities, but for all the companies that work in the energy industry. You'll see in the written testimony that I've submitted a short white paper. We titled it Rethinking Regulation. In a nutshell, we argue at Smart Grid Oregon that utility regulation has done a wonderful job. It has been responsible for what the National Academy of Engineering has unanimously decreed as being the singular most impressive engineering achievement of our lifetimes, of easily this century, which is the electricity grid. But utility regulation is designed to keep the lights on and to do it affordably. It is not designed to innovate. It is not designed to bring about change. Therefore, we argue that there is some opportunity that Smart Grid represents, introduces indeed, to rethink regulation. How can we understand the limitations of regulation in its traditional form and in turn innovate in regulation at the same pace or at least commensurately with the innovation taking place in the smart grid sector? To use an analogy, the internet in 1990, when I bought my first computer or had the opportunity to buy my first computer going off to school, I thought about the $2,000 PC that was on sale at the store, but I was thinking in terms of applications. I said, well, really I just need to write term papers. And so I did the least cost thing. I bought a $500 word processing typewriter. And we all know, anyone remember these things, we all know that the word processing typewriter did what it did and did it reasonably well. But of course, desktop publishing was the thing that took over. And desktop publishing was beautiful in my college experience because, well, when you've got one page of ideas and you've got a 10-page paper due, font size really matters. A couple of recommendations that I'd like to offer. Policy leadership is essential. As I've said before, utility regulation is built to do what it does, which is keep the lights on affordably, and it does it quite well. But leadership is a necessary ingredient. If we leave it to the engineers, if we leave it to utility regulation, we'll essentially be asking ourselves to put a man on the moon without John F. Kennedy calling us into action. We need policy leadership to show us the way, to set the goals, and to mobilize our action. As many of the witnesses today have explained, the smart grid, part of it involves automation, things that we'll never notice as consumers, but part of it also requires us to step up, to participate, to become active members of the energy system rather than passive consumers. I would also urge the committee to consider the opportunity to become more engaged in this issue because, quite frankly, the smart grid involves as much political acumen as it does engineering talent. Because it's asking consumers to rethink their own role in the energy system, there is the risk that an uninformed populace can become, let's say, resistant to the idea of change. Change must be introduced in a way that is palatable, that is accommodating, but that also is motivational. And this is more of a political problem than it is an engineering problem. The ability for the committee and the members of the legislature and the governor's office, the political spectrum across Oregon to become engaged, literate, and involved in this issue is essential if the smart grid is going to succeed in Oregon. And last but not least, I'd refer to the standards. Commissioner Savage mentioned some of the standards. There are two particular categories that must succeed in Oregon if we are to build the smart grid the right way. The first is interoperability. Interoperability sounds like a pretty technical term. In my own layman's understanding, it's the ability to make things work in a plug-and-play sort of fashion so that you don't have to think about it. In the early years of the electricity industry, there were dozens and dozens of standards for electricity outlets. If you bought an appliance from one company, it would only fit the outlet manufactured by a certain other company. And imagine what we would be at today if every time you bought an appliance, you'd have to ask yourself, oh, is this going to fit into my socket in my house? It never would have worked. Standards were necessary for the electricity to get to where it is, electricity sector to get to where it is today, and standards will be necessary going forward if Oregon businesses are going to be able to capitalize upon a much larger opportunity represented by the 3,000 utilities across America and the countless other utilities around the globe. If we can lead the way on standards in Oregon, or at the very least keep up with the standards that are emerging for the smart grid, that is the only hope for Oregon businesses to plug and play into that business opportunity. And last but not least, cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is a prerequisite for the smart grid. It's almost a cliche in movies today that there's some bad guy, and the bad guy usually has a computer whiz, and that computer whiz is usually sitting at a laptop somewhere in a basement and pushing a button and turning Washington, D.C. off, pushing another button and turning off a nuclear power plant, pushing another button and messing with the electricity grid. That is the worst-case scenario. However, not to leave you on a note of doom and gloom, I would urge you to consider that the smart grid, in fact, many ways, boosts the energy security of our electricity infrastructure. The ability to integrate variable renewable resources that would otherwise make it very challenging for the grid to remain stable. The ability to localize and contain outages so that we can avert, mitigate, and at the very least be better aware of the disasters, both man-made and natural, that can occur on the grid. Especially as we integrate more electric vehicles, we don't want to put our transportation sector also at risk to cybersecurity threats. That concludes my remarks today. I appreciate the opportunity, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, and I invite your questions.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, and thank you for the presentation. Michael, I was going to say, we don't need somebody pushing a button. We just need a lineman in Arizona. As you were saying that, I was thinking to shut down the entire Southwest. But really appreciate your presentation, and we do have a copy of the white paper that the staff handed out. Any questions for either of these gentlemen? Senator Prasansky?
Mr. Young, has your organization started looking at incentives as to what you think we can do to try to incentivize people to actually make these changes and stuff? Because it seems to me that if you want people to actually get there, you need to be able to show their benefits and how you can actually demonstrate that there's going to be something as a win for them. And I'm wondering if your organization has started looking at that for us or looking around the country and other places that what they've used to be attractive and successful.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Prasansky, it's an excellent question. We have looked at this, and one of the great virtues of Oregon is that in many ways the people of our great state already understand, have bought into many of the ends of the smart grid, whether it be integration of renewable resources, improving energy efficiency, integrating electric vehicles. These are all ends upon which much of Oregon agrees. The smart grid lets us get there faster, better, and cheaper. In other words, some customers are going to be motivated by reducing their carbon footprint. Other customers will be motivated by reducing their monthly bill. Other customers are going to be excited about being able to charge their new EV at an off-peak period, reducing both emissions and cutting on their costs. The ability for the smart grid to essentially micro-segment customers, we no longer have to do a one-size-fits-all for all customers when we are able to reach out to specific customers with very customized incentives. Information is a powerful incentive in and of itself. Right now, utility customers essentially do the equivalent of going to a grocery store, buying their groceries, and paying based on weight, whether it's caviar or cat food. For customers to have more information about the impact of their usage, both from a cost and an environmental and from a system reliability perspective, will in and of itself be a powerful motivator for many of the early adopters. And the early adopters, in many ways, will lead the way for the rest of the customer base to start participating more actively. That said, I personally believe that much of the success of the smart grid is going to come from set-it-and-forget-it type actions. Most of the time, we don't want to think about electricity. We use electricity so that we don't have to worry about things. We use a dishwasher so that we don't have to wash the dishes by hand. We do laundry machines because we don't want to do the laundry by hand. Most customers, I believe, are going to be motivated by some larger vision of reducing carbon emissions or by saving on their bills, but they're not going to participate on a day-to-day level because as the industry matures, these devices will do it automatically for them according to their preset preferences.
Thank you.
Thank you for the excellent question. And just a follow-up, I guess, comment, just to wrap up, I think that Senator Prasansky's question is a good one. And, of course, it's not just incentives for the customers, but incentives for the utilities, incentives for us as a region for greater reliability and coordination. And so I think what we're going to be doing is following up with the PUC. Certainly would like to make sure that we're kept informed of the upcoming workshop, and obviously if any of our members would like to attend, and then we'll probably have a follow-up presentation on that. And the question for in my mind is what, as policymakers, what type of policies do we need at the state level, if any, whether it's through the legislative process, which I'm not sure, I hadn't heard that yet today, so that's something I definitely want going to be following up with your group and the PUC on, or at the regulatory level. Obviously the PUC is exploring that right now, or are there barriers in regulation currently that we need to explore in order to promote the growth of these technologies? And I just want to say thank you to both of you. And before we take the last question, I also want to thank all the members who are here today, including Mr. Christensen, for coming all that way, and the utilities who are obviously embarking on this road. And we heard some very interesting details today about their program. So you get the last question, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Young. I have a question for you. With this new smart grid, the smart technology, would the consumer have the opportunity to choose his utility?
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson.
The question.
What?
That's more of a PUC question, but yeah.
The idea of market competition in utility regulation is one that has been debated quite vigorously over the past several decades. I would only add that smart grid technology opens up the door for an entirely new range of business models in the utility sector, which could include retail competition. It certainly has the potential to accelerate or improve that. But I would also note that it doesn't require competition in order for the smart grid to succeed. As examples, California and Texas are two states that are moving quite aggressively on the smart grid. Texas is fully deregulated from a retail competition point of view. Customers can choose their utility and choose their rates. California is not quite retail deregulated, but from a generation perspective is deregulated. So and then other states such as Ohio or even Oklahoma that are also moving forward at pace on smart grid are still vertically integrated in many ways.
Yeah.
So it is a flexible means, a flexible tool that can accelerate many different ends depending on what it is the will of the people is in the state.
See, I asked the right guy.
Did you want to respond at all as the regulator?
By
we'll let you have the last word.
Residential customers cannot shop around. Our business customers can.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why we're here as policy.
That's right.
Exactly. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Really
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. And thanks to everybody who participated today in that excellent discussion. And obviously, we'll be hearing more probably at our upcoming hearing. So thank you. So with that, we're actually going to shift gears a little bit and move on to yet another very interesting issue. We have Jennifer Allen, who's an associate professor of public administration at Portland State University, here to talk about leadership in sustainable chemicals policy. You will see a white paper that is sitting in front of you that she is a co-author of, and I've asked Jennifer to come here today and give us an overview. We apologize that we're running a little late, so you have 15-20 minutes with questions. We can shave a few minutes off of Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm sure would be happy to give up a few of their minutes up in the
What kind of chemicals
seat.
Are we talking about?
Well, I think that you're going to hear about that. So, yeah. And it looks like you got injured. I hope it wasn't.
Long story.
Okay. Well, hear about, hopefully it wasn't a chemical burn. Or
No. Last year I was attacked by a jar of homemade jam, but this was a little more dramatic than that. But
Thank you for being here.
Sure. Michelle. Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. There will not be a pop quiz at the end of my testimony on the white paper, although classes do start at Portland State next week. And what I wanted to do today is just share briefly the context for chemicals management, but really focus on some of the opportunities I think we have here in the state of Oregon to really, again, provide leadership in some innovative areas related to chemicals management. Briefly, I use the term sustainable in the title, and what I mean by that is really approaches that look at the social and the environmental impacts, but also critically the economic impacts, the costs and the benefits, and that does this in an integrated way. And I think that that's really central to the message in this report, is how do we do that in Oregon, and how can we really step out and lead on that front? Briefly, the existing framework we have for chemicals management at the federal level is shaped by a number of statutes, including the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, or FIFRA, that were passed many, many years ago. And they really set up a system that makes it very difficult for us to, again, look at chemicals management in this integrated way that really helps us look for economic opportunities as well as really being thoughtful about the environmental and social impacts of our chemical use. And the challenges in the system really relate to a couple of different things. The system sets us up to try to evaluate each of the 84,000 plus chemicals that we use now individually and try to figure out what their impacts are. And this is virtually an impossible task. And it's a very challenging, not just because of the number of chemicals, but because we increasingly realize how complex chemical behavior is. And so it asks us to look at an incredible number of different possible impacts on different people, on different populations, in different circumstances. Doesn't even get at how chemicals interact with each other. And so again, even if you threw tons of resources at it, very difficult to do. The other challenge in the system is lack of basic information. The system really isn't set up to generate good information about chemicals. There aren't good incentives for people to develop that information. Once again, this makes it very challenging. But stepping back, I think one of the key weaknesses, which is in fact an opportunity for Oregon, is that the system sets us up to chase what we don't want instead of encouraging us to look for what we do want. And the field of green chemistry didn't really exist when these statutes were passed. And the principles of green chemistry really give us the tools to develop substances that we know are going to be less toxic, that we know are going to be safer, and that really provide an opportunity, again, for economic leadership here in the state. And I think that that, again, is one of our critical opportunities here. So I want to just turn now to some of the opportunities, I think, for the state, and we can come back if you have questions more about the context. I think that there are one of the key areas where we could really help leverage our resources and be more effective is to look at greater coordination across state agencies. Right now, we have 7 agencies that have significant responsibilities for looking at chemicals, and right now, there's really no framework for them to look at where they're shared opportunities, priorities, concerns are, and leverage their resources toward those areas. Just one example might be that a number of agencies have identified chemicals of concern, but the State Fire Marshal's Office, which manages the fees for storage, that fee structure really doesn't provide any incentives for people to think about, gee, should I be looking at maybe some chemicals that are of less concern and therefore paying less fees in terms of my storage. The Department of Environmental Quality has really taken an initiative to address some of the internal lack of coordination through its toxics reduction strategy, where previously they had not had coordination, for instance, across their air, their land, their water programs in terms of their chemical management. They've moved ahead to create a comprehensive program that looks across all of those media. Chemicals flow across those media, they're recognizing that, and really try to, within the agency itself, create a more coordinated approach. The challenge is this really only applies to DEQ, and other state agencies don't share a similar framework across the state to look at where our shared priorities and our opportunities for coordination are. So one opportunity would be to encourage that conversation across state agencies to come up with a shared framework, a shared plan that aligns us around priorities and allows us to leverage our resources. In some ways, this is a good government opportunity. It really allows us to be more efficient and not be pulling a lever over here, which is creating a problem somewhere else. The second area of alignment, which I think is really where the opportunity for the state lies, is looking at alignment between our industry needs, our policy objectives, and our research and development investments. Oregon has tremendous bench strength in the area of green chemistry and development of alternatives. The Center for Sustainable Materials, which is a partnership between U of O and OSU, recently got a $20 million grant that was since this report was published. One example of, again, the national leadership in this area. ONAMI and Oregon Best, our signature research centers, already provide a structure to help channel university resources to industry to help with this, but I don't think we're leveraging this opportunity. We've got great strength, but what we don't have is a framework that aligns between our industry needs, our research and development capacity, and then once again, what are our goals as a state? And I think that that's an opportunity here where if we could be proactive about connecting those dots, I think that's where we can really help our industries address some of the potential costs that they might face, but really more importantly, leverage some of the competitive advantages of moving to new approaches. I think one thing that's critical to keep in mind in this is small business. We're a small business state in terms of numbers, in terms of employment. Some of the good examples of success you hear in this area are Nike, Columbia Forest Products, Blount Industries, all of whom are leaders in this area and have really stepped out in front. They have resources small businesses don't. So again, in this framework, how do we make sure we're engaging the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, our universities, small business programs, to really make sure that we're providing support to those businesses? The final thing I want to talk about has to do with information. There are three aspects to information I think are important here. One, going back to state agencies, is just encouraging a shared and coordinated information system across state agencies. State agencies should be able to find out what they already know across the state about different things, and once again, share information. It allows us to be more coordinated and more cooperative and not invest duplicative resources in collecting information. The second area, once again, touches on industry needs and opportunities. Are we making sure that our industries and our small businesses have access to the best databases available about alternatives? Do they have decision tools that can help them make their own decisions that are going to be right for them from an economic standpoint? But we really need to make sure they have access to the best possible thinking and the best resources out there. The final aspect of information that I think is important has to do with information for consumers and the public. If we can do a better job probably working with other states to encourage labeling, particularly of consumer products, that really provides information about what is in those products, that once again helps build a market. It helps build the economic incentives for businesses to start looking at alternatives. It gives consumers the information they need to make more knowledgeable decisions when they're purchasing. Consumer products is very challenging for any one state to tackle. So again, I think this is an opportunity for Oregon to work with other states to move this forward. A lot of what I've talked about here is about integration and coordination, and that sounds fairly sort of softball, but what I think it takes to really be effective in this is leadership and encouragement to all of our partners, industry, universities, agencies, to really step up and talk to each other and figure out how to work together in these areas. I think we have a culture here of public-private partnerships. I think we can really leverage that in this area. And once again, I think there are real opportunities for the state to be a leader in sustainable chemicals policy. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer, for the excellent overview. And I will encourage, yes, and I would encourage, if you haven't read this, I'd encourage you to take home and read it, because there's some excellent recommendations in here. And I thought it was also just to have everything all in one place. You know, and I know a lot of these programs exist, but to have this resource that pulls it all together, and I think those recommendations are really useful and timely. So any questions? I actually have a couple for Jennifer.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So Jennifer, one of the things that you brought up was about information for consumers and public. So for instance, you know, we have like the Salmon Safe program. Mm-hmm. Do you envision something like that for different chemicals? Because I will say that, you know, and obviously we worked on in this committee on bisphenol A, for instance, which is one of the many thousands of chemicals that you mentioned, and trying to find consistent information, labeling information is really difficult. So is there a model out there, is a model in Europe that you would look at as a suggestion?
Sure, and I do mention in the report the opportunity, I think, to work with voluntary certification programs in this area. There's actually been an effort involving the water management agencies to really look at ways that we can take, again, some of our policy priorities in Senate Bill 737, for example, what's come out of that, and then help involuntary certification programs integrate those. So once again, a business that wants to invest in the certification to get recognition for what it's doing also knows it's going to be in alignment with some of the policy areas. So once again, this is a win-win in many ways. It allows you to look at perhaps requirements, but also ways that you can get some market recognition. So whether we need a new certification program, I'm not sure. I think there are existing programs that we can work with Food Alliance, you know, the one that they're working on with Aqua. I think, once again, there's no one-size-fits-all answer for different industry sectors, and so I think you need to be really sensitive to what's going to be appropriate, both in terms of who their customers are, what the actual processes are in a business, and then therefore what certification programs are best aligned with a particular industry. I think Europe does offer some models or examples that we could certainly look at. But I, once again, I think the opportunity there is to have a dialogue about that with all of the affected parties and figure out what's the best way we can create this kind of alignment and engage the voluntary certification programs.
Senator Brzezinski, did you have a question?
No, I was just listening. I wasn't sure if I did or didn't. Sense of unique. I'm wondering, it sounds like the chair wants to maybe see us working on this for possible consideration in the future, 2013?
Well, we have actually in the past, you may recall, and I'm not sure, I think it was introduced this time over in the House, but I think two sessions ago we did introduce a bill looking at a comprehensive chemical policy for the state of Oregon, and part of the limiting factor for that is resources, and just we know that there's a lack of coordination and we need better coordination, and part of that was, you know, who would take that on, setting up the database, making sure that there's good communication. A few other states have done it already. I think California and Minnesota, I think I recall, and I think Maine is looking at it. And obviously, once California does it, that's sure. A great resource for many other states. So I don't know if you have any feedback or thoughts on that. You're probably familiar with the legislation that was introduced.
Yeah. Once again, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, coordination and integration takes time, and it takes effort, and it takes acknowledgement and support for people spending that time to work together. Obviously, there are resource needs. I think you should look to the university system in many ways to be able to help at least with some access, you know, some aspects of the kinds of information development that is needed. I think there are a lot of opportunities to partner with potentially both industry groups and also nonprofit organizations. So again, I would look at this as a multi-stakeholder opportunity as opposed to simply a state, you know, simply a state agency effort. And I think, once again, if you take that approach, it's going to be more likely that the outcome will be reflective, once again, of the needs and our goals, not just in terms of environmental and health impacts, but of our industry opportunities and needs. And I would really encourage you to set a table that is large enough to bring those perspectives together, because I think there are benefits on all fronts to a more comprehensive chemicals policy in terms of streamlining, in terms of how many different kinds of requirements industries are being asked to meet, and are there ways that we can, you know, create a more, again, streamlined and efficient and effective opportunity that's going to make it easier to engage all of the partners that really need to be engaged in this effort.
Great. So I think that answers your question, but definitely the chair is interested and will be following up on this. We have a number of industry representatives here. We don't have you scheduled for coming up to the podium, but we definitely, I think, you know, in future committee meetings, want to hear from the industry perspective, which I know you've been working very closely with, Jennifer. So, but I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule, seeing that school's about to start, to be here today. And we certainly will, I think, be following up, and you had a lot of good recommendations in here. Did you have any other questions?
Okay. Great. Thanks. I appreciate it.
All right.
Appreciate
you.
The time. Thanks a lot.
And we're actually back on track time-wise now to finish up our committee hearing today. And as you know, being the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, we do everything from energy to chemical policy to fishery and hatchery issues. So we are now going to hear from I had asked the Department of Fish and Wildlife to come provide a hatchery overview. This is sort of a hatchery 101 for those folks who are not familiar with their hatchery policy here in Oregon. And we will be having some follow-up discussions on hatchery issues in the future. So we have Ed Bowles, who's the administrator of the Fish Division from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And thank you, Ed, for being here today. And I know we have going to have an interesting presentation. Look at all those boats in the water.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to come share with you what I think is a very good story about Oregon's hatchery program. And I'm going to walk you through some of this based on some questions that were provided by the committee administrator woven into this presentation, and hopefully we'll have a chance to answer some questions, and if we need to follow up, we can do so later. It is a big program. I'm going to focus primarily on talking a little bit about the policies that guide our hatchery program, the breadth of those programs in Oregon, and some of the challenges and opportunities that we have facing us. An obvious question is, why do we have this tool to help us in fish management? And just to kind of set the stage, The vast majority of Oregon's hatcheries are what are termed mitigation hatchery programs. So the majority of fish that we release are mitigation for lost fish, primarily due to hydropower development in the Willamette and the Columbia, as well as some other drainages. But the reason that we have hatcheries is a societal decision years back to use this tool as a way to mitigate for losses due to those dramatic changes in the fish's ecosystem. So this just shows, just for an example, historically, some of the estimates are anywhere from 10 to 15 million salmon and steelhead returning to the Columbia annually. And currently, we were down, obviously, much, much below that at the current time. For the mouth of the Columbia, it's basically a 90% reduction. The hatchery tool was designed to help mitigate for that hydrosystem as well as other impacts, blockages, and reduced productivity or survival of these fish. And so this tool is often looked at and should be looked at in a critical way relative to how it is doing relative to the wild fish. But bear in mind that the main purpose of this is to replace lost fish provided for societal benefits to fisheries, commercial and sport, and that it is struggling to meet those mitigation responsibilities for a number of reasons, but without it, we would not have the fisheries even that we have today. And the hatcheries did not cause this problem. I want to be real clear on that. There are hatchery impacts. But this huge decline, the hatchery tool was selected to try to mitigate for those declines. It did not cause those declines from a large perspective. Hatchery management is driven by three foundational policies in the state of Oregon, and these were all adopted in the early 2000s. The hatchery policy itself really describes the hatchery tool and the range of its applications across the landscape. It does not dictate whether or not where the hatchery's impacts are going to be throughout the state, and that is really comes apart in the more foundational policy, which is our native fish conservation policy. And this policy establishes the conservation platform or foundation for Oregon's native wild fish throughout the state, and it's on that platform that these hatchery programs should exist and operate. So the native fish policy really determines the use of hatcheries, the tool in the specific watersheds, and making sure that it's compliant with conservation needs. And then our other one is the fish health policy, which minimizes fish health issues in hatcheries and the surrounding waters. So those are the foundational policies driving our hatchery programs. Now, hatcheries have changed dramatically over the course of the last several decades. Up until a couple decades ago, really the hatcheries were primarily conventional hatchery programs who measured success in the how many smolts. These are for salmon and steelhead that I'll be talking about here. How many smolts they produce. These are the young fish heading out to the ocean. And how many, what was the survival of those fish in the hatchery? That really looked as success as what we're doing in the hatchery operation. That is really, as a result of hatchery reform and other issues, it's really seen a shift now to really having three specific objectives related to these types of hatchery programs. One is the harvest programs. These hatcheries are there to provide fish for harvest. And now the objectives aren't how many smolts you can produce or what the survival is in the hatchery, but more how many adults are coming home. How can you maximize the survival of these fish after you release them? And how can you do this in a way that minimizes impacts to the wild and naturally produced fish in the watersheds? Another type of program is a conservation hatchery program. And these are relatively new and still a bit unproven. And these are hatcheries specifically designed to increase the numbers of wild fish, not with a primary purpose for harvest, but to actually help recover wild fish. And in increasing the numbers, how do you do that in a way that doesn't erode the productivity of fish in these wild areas, these watersheds? And then the third is more of the draconian approach. For example, Redfish Lake sockeye, condor-type program where the fish are so deteriorated that you have to take them into protective custody, kind of a genetic repository, until the world's a safer place for them to flourish. So that is the current state of how we're looking at our hatcheries. We have three general hatchery objectives, kind of the conservation or fishery benefits. These are the objectives of your hatcheries, and all our hatcheries must have explicit objectives associated with them relative to their conservation role or their fishery benefits. And then in meeting those objectives, we also have criteria for being good neighbors to the wild fish, making sure that that does not come at the expense of wild fish. And then also the third one is these hatcheries themselves have impacts. So these hatcheries have to be good residents within their watersheds due to pathogens, chemicals, and pollutants. Now, conservation, as I mentioned, the native fish conservation policy is the foundational policy upon which our hatchery programs should be implemented. We have been spending the last decade since the adoption of the native fish conservation policy in developing these conservation plans that set that foundation. It's been a work in progress. I'm very pleased to say that since the policies were adopted 2003 or 2002, within a decade of those adoptions, we're going to have, this will be by the end of next year, we'll have nearly all of our salmon and steelhead species throughout the state. We'll have a conservation platform defined and criteria lined out for those conservation needs of those populations. 20 of 22 will be completed by the end of 2012. So we're shifting from a planning phase to an implementation phase of implementing the actions from those plans. And in that requires a reassessment of our hatchery programs to make sure they are aligned appropriately with these conservation programs. For example, we completed a plan a few years ago for coastal coho. That required a realignment of our coastal coho hatchery programs to be complementary to those conservation needs, and that is the current hatchery program for coho that we have on the coast. We'll be doing the same thing throughout as these plans. And it's important that we do the conservation planning first and the hatchery alignment sequentially so that you don't have the tail wagging the dog, so to speak. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what are we doing in the interim for some of these. But we're very proud of getting these done within a decade. This just shows just a perspective of where most of the hatchery programs are. The little fish symbols are the hatcheries, and we've got most of these, as you'd expect, in the lower Columbia and in the northwest parts part of the state, the vast majority. We did close one hatchery as a result of budget constraints last session, and that's Butte Falls down in the lower portion of the southwest region. So I'm going to give you some factoids now about the hatchery program, and I'm going to run through quite a bit, and then we can come back around if you want to drill in a little bit on these. But we have now 32 hatcheries, of which 18 are these mitigation hatcheries, 15 satellite facilities for like collecting fish or acclimation sites, 47 step propagation facilities, which are mainly small places to collect or release fish, some rearing. Now, of these, there are 75 hatchery programs for salmon and steelhead. Those are distinct programs that we have set objectives for and management approaches. 20 of those 75 are mitigation, but that represents 80% of all the salmon and steelhead we release are associated with mitigation programs, primarily for dams constructed in the Willamette and the Columbia basins. Okay. That's the other 20% are ones that we have more discretion on relative to providing harvest augmentation just additional harvest, primarily on the coast and a few other places. And then we have 15 programs that are specific to conservation programs. Those are mainly in the northeast part of the state, in the upper Snake River drainages, or the Snake River drainages, the Grand Ronde, those. All told, 45 million annual release from our hatcheries, of which just under 40 million are salmon and steelhead. About 4 million of those are step, but half of those are unfed fry. The rainbow trout program, which I didn't plan on talking much about today, I do have some information if you'd like it. We released just over 5 million associated with that. And we have just shy of 1 million of other species, such as kokanee, but those are minor compared to our bread and butter programs. Now, of the salmon and steelhead, we're pretty close to having all of those marked now, which I think is a very healthy place to be, both for evaluating our hatcheries and for marked selective fisheries that we have throughout the state. One thing that really isn't an objective, but an interesting aside, is that these hatcheries, where they're sited and others, they've become quite a an important place for people to come and visit. And so we use these as educational opportunities with kiosks and other informational displays to help folks understand the hatchery tool and the importance of the wild fish and the importance of particularly salmon and steelhead, but other fisheries in the state. We have over 1.5 million visitors per year to our hatchery system, so it's quite a network of outreach to these rural areas. Now, I try to get at some of these questions that were posed, and I want to first talk a little bit about where we release our fish throughout the state. And these are salmon and steelhead in those rivers that have those. For river units, we had to pick some common sort of units. So basically, we don't put hatchery fish for these stream units in about 40% of them. We put hatchery fish in about 60% of our salmon and steelhead stream units. And of those, about 15% are fish that are not indigenous or native to that water body. Most of those are, for example, Skamania stock, which is a Washington stock of summer steelhead. So those would be in areas that don't currently have summer steelhead. A lot of those occur on the in the Willamette Valley or on the coast. Most of our hatchery programs, 45% of those water units, stream units, have hatchery fish that are indigenous to the watershed released into them. Now, I told you about this interim. We have what's called, we call them HGMPs. That acronym means Hatchery Genetic Management Plans. Those are the mother mayi that we have to get from the federal government, NOAA Fisheries, for all of our hatchery programs to be able to operate them in the face of the Endangered Species Act. Okay? So this is our way of getting permission from the feds to run our hatcheries. And for our 78 salmon and steelhead hatchery programs, we have completed the HGMPs for all of them, every one of our programs. Most of these have been complete for nearly a decade. The federal government has not reviewed those, all but four of them, and those four are approved. They've been sitting on those. It's a source of incredible frustration for us and exposes us to some vulnerabilities that we don't care for. But that is the nature of how NOAA has been operating, and I can understand it from some aspects because, once again, they're in the process of completing federal recovery plans. They want to make sure that they get those plans done first before they give a verdict on the hatchery programs so that they can make sure that, once again, the tail's not wagging the dog. So we've got commitments from the federal government, because we have now nearly completed all these recovery plans and conservation plans, that they will expedite approval of the HGMPs. And it's an iterative process, but we're very pleased that our part, all we can do, is done, and those plans are all in the queue with the feds right now.
And Just a quick question. Yeah. So are all of these, are they within an ESU? I mean, I'm assuming there's a nexus with the Endangered Species Act for and then where would U.S. Fish and Wildlife fit in here?
Chair Dingfelder, it's amazing how little nexus there needs to be. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the species of the hatchery program is listed. It's just if it's released in any water body, and that's basically everything. So pretty much all of our water bodies for salmon and steelhead have something listed in them. And so we basically have to do an HGMP for every one of our salmon steelhead programs.
You mentioned NOAA, so does U.S. Fish, say, in Eastern Oregon have any review on?
Not for salmon and steelhead. There's a different permit process for example, bull trout, red ben, and those.
I think for bull trout or red ben, if there's an analogous process.
What we get is we've worked through our fishery plans. We don't have any hatchery programs per se on those, and so we have not done HGMPs for those and aren't required to. But we are doing approvals for our fishery management plans, which is another evaluation, and that can be through the Fish and Wildlife Service or the NOAA fisheries. Now, our funding for hatcheries is quite varied. We have 8 that are state-funded only, and that would be either through licensed dollars or general funds. We have 12 federally funded and 12 that have a mixed bag in them. And Fish Division is blessed to have roughly $82 million per year authorized by the legislature, and this is for 11-13. Of that, within Fish Division, we have 4 primary budgetary programs. So this shows you how that is funded within that $82 million. Roughly, our hatchery program, which is propagation, gets just shy of a third of that at 31%. Nearly 50% goes for our natural production budgetary program. And then we've got IJ is what we term interjurisdictional fisheries. That's the Columbia River and the ocean salmon sort of fisheries that are multi-jurisdictional with treaties and tribes and other states and nations. And then the marine program, which is the non-salmon piece of this, of the marine program, is all the other species off the coast. So propagation, 31%. Now, within that propagation budget of $25 million per year, the vast majority of that, two-thirds, is federal funds. Like I said, most of it through mitigation programs. We only have, as you're well aware, we're down to only 9% general fund now from tax revenues. And then the other is 24%, and that's licensed dollars and contract. We call that other funds through contract services with, for example, PGE, mitigation, Pacific Corps, things like that, that make up that other box. Distribution of those funds, these are for $2009 dollars, because we haven't done the full allocation for this biennium yet. But this is just to show you, the left side shows you the region, Northwest, Southwest, High Desert, Northeast, and then our administration cost, our fish health section, our fish ID, which is the marking program, and then the engineering. Kind of shows you how those funds are distributed in, for 2009. And you can see the vast majority of the dollars for propagation goes to the Northwest region, where we have most of those mitigation hatcheries in place. I want to close with some discussion of the challenges and opportunities ahead of us. One of these is the role of hatcheries in conserving and rebuilding wild runs. This is still an open question for the hatchery tool, and is one that we are exploring aggressively with the Hatchery Research Center, the Oregon Hatchery Research Center, over on Fall Creek in the Alsea Basin. And that is an old hatchery that's been retrofitted to be a state-of-the-art research facility to address important questions regarding our hatchery programs and how well they interact with our wild fish. And Dr. Noakes and his crew have been very aggressive in taking on some of the tough questions. We're beginning to get the sort of data that is allowing us to get a glimpse into some of these interactions, and we're very pleased with that. and that'll be forthcoming over the next several years. Another one is, how do we meet our harvest mitigation objectives consistently? You remember that first slide of why we have hatcheries. Even though the hatchery tool was picked to mitigate for much of the deterioration we had with our Columbia River salmon, we aren't consistently providing the numbers of fish to fully mitigate. And the impacts of that, if we just added more and more hatchery fish, would not be good for the wild fish. So we need to improve the survival of fish in that system. Aligning hatchery programs with conservation needs. This alignment is going to be taken on in earnest. It's already been done for the plans that are completed, and we are in the process of, as these plans are being done, the next several years, we will be focusing on aligning our hatchery programs to be complementary and consistent with all of our conservation plans throughout the state. A key issue for us, and this relates to hatchery reform, we've all got some great ideas on hatchery reform, but a lot of that requires infrastructure changes, different types and placement of our holding facilities, our ponds, our acclimation. We're living with a hatchery infrastructure that's very aged and still lives in that old paradigm of maximizing smolts and maximizing in-hatchery survival, and isn't nimble enough to deal with smaller containers and the flexibility needed to meet the future. Budgets obviously aren't going to address that right now, but it is an ongoing challenge, one, to keep our crumbling infrastructure intact, and two, to reform that in an appropriate way to meet the future demands. And it's really, the ideas are there, it's really a budgetary constraint at this time. We are very proud of our fish health program, reducing risk from fish pathogens. In fact, we just received an award a couple years ago from the American Fisheries Society for the status of our fish health program in Oregon. It's a model for the nation. Another challenge is providing consistent trout fisheries, and then expanding monitoring programs for adaptive management. This relates to the ability to learn. We've got standards and objectives that we'll be implementing for our hatcheries, but in order to get the feedback of whether or not they're meeting those standards and objectives, we've got to be able to invest in monitoring the fish coming home, the relationships with the wild fish, all those sorts of things. We have a good monitoring program, but maintaining that in the face of budget problems is always a challenge. So that's all I've got. Chair Dingfelder, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ed. Before I take questions, first of all, I have to say that I gave Ed an entire list of questions, and that's part of how this presentation was put together, which we'll be continuing to explore during the interim. So we appreciate you pulling that together. So I think just want to let the committee know that this is the beginning of ongoing discussions that we'll be having during the interim. But with that, I'll open up, see if there's any questions from our resident fishermen, maybe. No? Oh. You've left them speechless. Yeah. Any questions on this end?
That fish got away.
Maybe. Yeah. Senator Thompson.
If you know that you've got some repairs to make or some changes, why don't you, or why haven't you put in your budget in the past a fund for future infrastructure?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Thompson.
Asked by a true Ways and Means Committee.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Senator Thompson, you know, as on the Ways and Means sub, you're familiar with our budget from the past several. We do have some funds that we use to deal with deferred maintenance and our restoration enhancement fund we can use for chronic problems and addressing immediate hatchery needs. But we did several years ago a huge analysis about 5 years ago of our deferred maintenance needs and the budgetary needs for that, provided it to the legislature on some of these major big ticket things. And we would have to ask for those enhancements through policy option packages. And to be honest, in these budgetary climates and the fact that these would have to come through license or general fund revenues, have been provided the direction that it just hasn't been appropriate. That need has been identified, but the ask, we've been cautious to do that, particularly because if it, without new money, it would come at the expense of other programs. Mm-hmm. So we'd like to be looking at other creative ways to do this, perhaps outside of our traditional funding sources. Thank you.
And I'm going to actually follow up a little bit on that, because looking at your slide, so right now, I'm looking at the third to last, or one of the pie chart slides that you have, the propagation costs on. Now, this is just propagation. You also have fish division. So going back to hatcheries by fund source, you have 32 total, and you have the funding is...
Is this one?
No, well, that's part of it, but that's only prop... Well, so the, go back one more. So you have to read by fund source, but as far as dollar amounts, so it, I'm assuming the general fund is going to be partially the state and mixed. What's the breakdown between general fund fees, mitigation? And part of the, you've already responded to Senator Thompson's question, but obviously if we're talking general fund, there's a trade-off between funding maintenance of hatcheries versus more days in the classroom or people in the Oregon Health Plan. Can you talk a little bit about overall what the cost is to the state, what that source of funding is, you know, that can match up for this? And I don't know if it's, is it a subset of, is propagation a subset? It's hard to tell from these three different pie charts.
Chair Dingfeller, I think this slide probably gets at it best. Just looking at the propagation program, of the $25 million, 9% is general fund, all right? And I think that, what does that come out to, about $2.25 million?
That's per biennium or per year?
Per year. And so we get $4.5 million per biennium. And we're very, believe me, very grateful to have that. But we understand that represents pretty serious reductions from what we've had in the past. The other fund aspect is licensed dollars. There isn't really commercial fish fund in this, but it's primarily for the propagation program. It's primarily licensed dollars and these other fund, as you're familiar with, which is these outside non-federal contract dollars. And that's split about 60-40 in that. And then the federal piece of it is almost entirely the mitigation piece through CORE, Bonneville. But there is also some sport fish restoration dollars, which is through federal aid through the Fish and Wildlife Service. And that's the breakdown. And we've got all the budgetary details for that that we can, you know, if we want to do follow-up sometime, I can give you the exact details. And we've provided that to the Ways and Means Committee.
It might be helpful for the committee to have that since we are looking at policy. But obviously, the funding... mechanism is an integral part of that policy, so appreciate that. We do have I do have other questions that I'm going to be asking the Department of Fish and Wildlife to come back and answer in our, probably in our November or January. I have to look at the timing for that committee meeting, so I'm not going to go into that now because I'd already asked Ed to sort of put together this presentation based on a list of questions that I had given him. So with that, any other questions for the Department of Fish and Wildlife for right now? We will be following up, looking at other areas of discussion around hatchery reform in the future. Senator Morse had also requested to have some discussions. Unfortunately, couldn't be here because I think he's out of town this time, but I'm hoping he'll be here in November. And I don't know if, Kurt, if you wanted to add anything.
Nothing at this time, and I think then Chair Dingfelder will, on any follow-up sort of things, we'll wait to hear if you want to drill down any of these questions, and then we'll provide something later in that light. Okay?
Okay. I guess okay? The first, if you could just follow up providing the
a detail on the...
Yeah, I think that'd be helpful for all the committee members to have.
Great.
Any other questions before we let him go? We release him.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Ed. With that, that's the end of our agenda, actually. We're a little bit early. Beth, do we have anything else, that any other committee business we need to?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. So with that, gentlemen, we are adjourned.